to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 234. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always, my bros, James Jones.
Hey.
My hoes, John Lindemann.
What's up, party people?
What?
My foes, Greg Leahy.
Bloody hell.
What the fuck was this?
I could have gone with Melissa Leo's Oscar acceptance speech, but
we couldn't actually hear quite what she said there, but anyway, this is the last episode of RFN before PAX East. So we do have a big show for you this week. We're going to start off with a whole bunch of new business, and we've got Now Playing, of course.
Oh, fuck.
Maybe a surprise in the middle. And we're going to wrap up with as much listener mail as we can get to. So, first up, I'll kick off new business with BitTrip Flux. This just hit WiiWare earlier this week, or about a week ago by the time the show comes out. And, you know, it's the final BitTrip game. It's 6 of 6. And at this point, I feel like everybody should pretty much have a good idea of what they're going to get out of these games. And you should doubly have an excellent idea for Flux, because it's pretty much a retread of BitTrip Beat, the first game. And certainly Beat was one of my favorite in the series up to now. And I think for the most part, Flux is an improvement. It's basically Pong against AI, to put it very simply. It's musical Pong. And it's still really, really hard. The music's pretty good. I think the music might actually be better than in Beat. And it's, you know, it's very colorful. It still goes through the different graphical modes depending on how well you're doing or how close you are to failing out. The main difference is there's a sort of superficial difference in that the Pong bar that you're moving up and down is on the right side of the screen instead of the left. I think the idea being that Commander Video has kind of come full circle and he's now returning home, whatever that means.
Don't read too deeply into it.
Well, seriously, every time you hear Gaijin Games talk about this series, Alex Noisy starts raving about the story and about how, you know, he tried to say BitTrip Fate was like the Empire Strikes Back of the series. It's like, dude, what are you smoking? I mean, have I not unlocked the text feature or the voice acting in this game? The series is so abstract. I don't really think there is a story. I mean, if there's a story, it's in Alex Noisy's head. I don't think any of these games really convey a story, anything more meaningful. I mean, it's very thematic, you know. In some cases, like in Runner, he goes from like the more country areas to the more city areas. Read into that what you will, but it's not a very impactful narrative throughout the franchise. But aside from the game being basically mirrored, and there being a few different kinds of beats in this one, the main difference is that the checkpoint system is a lot different. Actually, the first game didn't have checkpoints at all. You had to play through the entire level. There were 3 levels, and you had to play through the entire level in one go in order to beat it and move on to the next one. And in Flux, they've divided the levels are still really long. They're like 10-15 minutes long a piece, but they've split them into like 8 or 9 chunks a piece, and each one has a checkpoint. So if you die, if you do poorly, the worst that could happen is you'll go back about 2 minutes of gameplay, probably. So that's really not bad at all. And it makes the game, I mean, I think this one is at least as difficult as BitTrip Beat, but it makes it somewhat less frustrating because you don't have to replay a bunch of stuff that you know you can get through. You know, like it feels like you can just keep on pushing, and it makes you want to try that one part that you have trouble with over and over and over and over until you get through it. And for me, so far, I have been able to get through everything. But I am now on the 3rd level out of 3, and there's just a point where it gets so insane. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through it. I really don't. I mean, I can get back to that point easily, but there's just this one section that's psychotic, and it can only get worse from there, really. So, I mean, the pace of the game does feel different because of the checkpoints, and overall I'd say this one's less frustrating, but it's still really difficult. And, you know, the fact remains that if you get to a point that you just simply cannot get past, you're not going to finish the game. So that's kind of disappointing. For me, at least I made it to the 3rd level, and I got to kind of see most of the elements in the game. For some people, they may not be able to get that far, and they're going to be pissed off about it, you know. So I guess you could say that about all of the BitTrip games, though. They're all really hard. The one other thing I wanted to mention, well, 2 things. These are annoyances, okay? First off, the tilt control, I like it. You know, I think it works well. I think it's a very good use of the Wiimote, and it's very, very sensitive to the point where I almost have to hold it like on my fingertips so I can get like the fastest rotation possible, because this game's so demanding. But they do this thing where if you pause the game with the minus button, you select things on the pause menu through rotation also, which means you can accidentally quit your game if you happen to be holding the controller with the wrong orientation when you hit the button. And it doesn't even say, "Are you sure?" At
nice.
One point, I got to the boss of the second level and hit pause to get up and get a glass of water or something, came back, hit the two button, and was back at the main menu. And I had to play through that entire level over again because of bad menu design. Not good, guys. That's really bad. That's bad UI, okay? The other thing is, BitTrip Flux is 800 Wii points, BitTrip Beat is 600 Wii points, and they're pretty much the same game. Just saying.
The checkpoint premium worth paying,
yeah.
You think?
Apparently they're not charging me $2 extra because they fixed it.
Couldn't they have just made it DLC for like 100 and called it a day?
You know, and there still aren't online leaderboards, which people have been, including me, have been asking for from the very beginning, which was over a year ago when the first game came out. And it doesn't seem like all that much to ask for, really. So I'm recommending it if you love the other BitTrip games.
I mean, what would you say that, for me, I never got around to Beat, even though it seems, you know, appealing, and I played the demo and thought it was quite good, I just didn't get around to it.
Sure.
What would you recommend I do faced with the choice between the 600 and 800 point games?
You know, if $2 isn't very meaningful to you, I'd say Flux is a little bit better. It's certainly, I think the music's a little better. I think the graphics are slightly better. And the checkpoint system makes a big difference to the playability. It really does. So I'd say Flux is the better game, but by a hair, you know, it's a really negligible difference. The other thing is Beat starts out easier because they're sort of teaching you to play the game. Whereas I feel like Flux, it sort of starts out expecting you to know pretty much what you're doing. But if you've played the demo for Beat, you're probably okay. Flux is still good, but it's like, I was hoping over the course of, you know, like a year and a half of making these games, a lot of feedback, going through several different game types, that all this, and for a while it felt like it was evolving, you know, when they went to Analog Control and Void, and then they went to BitTrip Runner with the full color graphics and the, you know, just beautiful presentation, the awesome music. Fate seemed like an interesting idea that just didn't quite pan out, and then Flux feels like just, I mean, it is literally a step all the way back to the beginning, but it just feels like they haven't learned that much in the process. You know, they figured out, oh, we should put in checkpoints so the game, you know, so people don't throw their controllers at the screen, but that's about all they've done to it, and I'm kind of disappointed in that. You know, I still want to see what these guys do. I think they probably have a bright future ahead of them on 3DS, and maybe more WiiWare, so we'll see. One other download game I played this week is Pixel Junk Shooter 2, which of course is from Q Games, run by our friend Dylan Cuthbert, who has done a lot of Star Fox and art style games. And, you know, I love the first Pixel Junk Shooter, and I know you did too, Greg.
Yep.
2 is not as much fun, unfortunately. I mean, it plays just the same, and there's some new elements in there that are really cool. You know, the whole game is about all these fluids interacting with each other and stuff like that, these sort of puzzle-type level designs. And that stuff is back, but it seems like there's a lot more enemies this time, and they're a lot more aggressive. And the game overall, I'd say, is about twice as hard as the first one.
It was really quite gentle. It was quite relaxing to play, the original, I thought.
Until you got to the very end. And this one feels like it starts from the difficulty of the very end of the first one, and then it just goes up and up from there.
It's kind of interesting that, because, I mean, given that it's now been, what, more than a year since the original Pixel Junk Shooter, it might be a bit more to expect people to kind of hit the ground running with it than if it had come out, you know, 6 months ago or something.
Sure, yeah. I guess my problem is the levels don't really feel very much different from before. The general, you know, the way the levels are laid out, the way you get through them, there's some clever stuff, but I wouldn't say more clever than the first game, and it really feels like more of the same overall. It's just way harder. And all the Pixel Junk games have been hard except for the first shooter. And for me, that was a relief, because I enjoyed enjoying the game. I mean, I don't mind levels of difficulty, but this one, you know, there's no selectable difficulty or anything like that. It's just hard right from the beginning. And right now I'm on the third world, basically. So I've been through many, many, many levels of it. And it's just getting harder and harder and harder to the point where sometimes I pick up the game and I play for 30 minutes and I make no progress. It's not really a good feeling. And it's, you know, it sort of takes away from something I actually liked about the first game. So I'm not totally down on it, but again, I don't really know what these guys learned in the time that they spent making the second game. It doesn't really feel like a step forward for me.
It's like multiplayer or something, isn't there? I mean, that's, I guess, it's a fairly significant new element, but not one that I'll probably ever get anything out of.
Yeah, the first one had local co-op, which is something I've never been able to try. I'd like to, because it seems like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
This one has online competitive play, which is not really what I was looking for, but I'll probably try it out. I haven't touched it yet, though. One other game this week, I actually rented this and beat it in a weekend, is Enslaved, Journey to the West, which came out last fall. It's on Xbox and PS3, and it's from the guys who made Heavenly Sword, and they're set to make the new Devil May Cry, actually.
Yeah.
And Enslaved is sort of loosely based on the...
Journey to the West.
Oh, it's just called Journey to the West? Okay. Yeah, the same thing that Dragon Ball Z is based on, and I guess someone... I said earlier a few weeks ago that Sonic is based on it too, and then someone wrote back and corrected me and said, no, Sonic's pretty much based on Dragon Ball Z, because it has a lot of stuff that's in Dragon Ball Z, but it's not actually in the original Chinese folktale, so, or epic poem, or whatever it is. So that's kind of interesting, but Enslaved is a character action game, third person. It reminds me a lot of Uncharted or Prince of Persia. In some ways, even Eco, because there's a lot of basically you interacting with this girl who's controlled by the computer, and you're trying to cooperate and do things together. She's definitely more capable than the girl in Eco, but she's still very fragile. She can't really fight enemies, so you have to protect her in some cases. There's a lot of good platforming, a lot of, you know, just like Prince of Persia or Uncharted or even Tomb Raider, there's a lot of climbing around on walls, swinging around flagpoles and things like that, basically. But it's really good. The combat's fun. It's mostly melee combat. There's some interesting elements of distracting. There's some kind of stealth elements. They're pretty minor, but they're fun to play. And the main thing about Enslaved, I really feel like the gameplay is, it's good, but it's not great or excellent overall. It feels like bits and pieces of a lot of other games put together. And where it really shines is in the storytelling, because the voice acting and the character animation and the staging of the cutscenes is, I think, pretty much on par with Uncharted, which is just about the highest watermark there is in video games right now. And seeing these characters interact is really entertaining, because it's a little more of a sci-fi setting than Uncharted from the very beginning. You know, they're in this world, you find out pretty much right off the bat that they're in some kind of future version of America, some kind of like post-civilization America, where they go through New York City and it's like overgrown with jungle, basically. And you're going through there, and then every now and then you catch these glimpses of what life used to be like back in what is today modern times. And it's kind of interesting. It's mysterious, you know. Like, as you play through the game, you sort of learn more and more about this world that the characters are in, and how they're dealing with it and what they plan to do about it. So I really enjoyed that. And it's the first game I can think of in a while where I feel like the narrative actually pulled me through finishing the game more than the mechanics did, which I'm just not that kind of a person, but I think it's so well done and Enslaved that it did work for me. So I would say definitely check it out. It seems like it's been kind of overlooked for the most part, but it's really, it's quite a good game. And, you know, it's short, but I think as a rental, it's really kind of the perfect length for like a weekend blow through it. So James, you're up next.
I don't have a lot to talk about. Blazed through the rest of Radiant Historia. I think I finished it at about the 32-hour mark. I then looped back around and finished off some of the 36 subquests that are in the game with the intention of unlocking the so-called true ending. That brought me about 38 hours. I still have a handful of quests left. The review should be up now, and I really like this game a lot. For whatever reason, it's just not quite... I think the term I use in the review is transcendent.
So for you, you're saying this is not, it's not Chrono Trigger all over again.
Well, see, Chrono Trigger didn't hit that area for me either.
Oh, you heathen. Okay.
But you know, but every person has a thing. It's not easily quantifiable, but. Oh,
I can tell you, you just haven't put enough hours into Chrono Trigger, James. I mean, not like I have.
I beat it 4 times, John. You're good to go.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, James.
But for whatever reason, this game just kind of fell outside it.
But I assume that is a very exclusive club.
Oh, yeah. There are a handful of games that hit that territory.
So we're still talking about it's in the real upper stratosphere.
Yeah, it's still fantastic. Now, what's weird, though, is that it doesn't necessarily have to be a great game that hits that area. Infinite Space ostensibly gets a lower score than Radiant Historia, but it falls into that territory because of other stuff it does. In a way, it's got its own specialness that makes it emotionally attached, more so than this title. But this is still a really amazing game, and there's no reason not to own it except that Atlas sold all 8 copies they produced.
It's, I suppose, an opportune time perhaps to mention that there are no plans for this to be published in Europe by anyone currently, which, at the moment, you know, there's always the option to import, but it does bring home the reality of just how painful situations like this may be in the 3DS future of region locking.
It doesn't make sense that Atlas isn't planning an import for this game because they own it. I mean, it's not like they're paying the license holder. I mean, this is their game.
Well, Atlas doesn't have a European office.
Yeah.
So they have to find a partner. And I think Namco does a lot of publishing for them in Europe, but they don't publish everything.
It's patchy. That's right.
They should just go to Nintendo for this case. It sounds like the game is so good.
It's really good. I mean, it's really, really good. It's this nice mix of classic RPG elements with some new stuff thrown in there and some enhancements. One of the people in the forum noted that it sounds a little bit like Majora's Mask. And I can there's a little bit of that going on there.
Yeah.
You don't hear many games compared to Majora's Mask.
I mean, just the way you described last week, the sort of flitting back and forth to fix problems. Obviously, you've got more flexibility because you've got 2 timelines that you're jumping between, and you know, you're not just on that 3-day cycle, but there's definitely a similarity there.
Right. It's basically 6 months versus 3 days. The decision-making that went into its design would be just amazing to hear, because at some point, They made some very unexpected decisions with how they wanted to make this game. So maybe one day we'll get to hear more about it. But I'm kind of depressed now to hear that there's no European release plan still. I guess though it runs into that situation where the 3DS is kind of breathing down its neck.
Well, I mean, the timing. I think their timing options in America certainly could left something to be desired, considering it was coming out alongside Dragon Quest VI and Tactics Ogre.
And right before Pokemon.
Yeah, even on the DS, it fell between Dragon Quest VI and Pokemon Black
the
and
two,
White.
The two of the real titans of RPG. I mean, there weren't really very many good options.
No, they were kind of stuck in the we're screwed either way spot. And then at the end of the month comes the 3DS. It's sort of a bad place to be releasing another RPG, especially considering that those two are both published by Nintendo.
Although, if I was getting a 3DS on launch day, which I probably won't be, I would love to have a brand new DS RPG to play on it.
Well, because you're gonna eat up a lot of time.
Yeah, I mean, what are you gonna play for 38 hours on the 3DS?
If you're not, oh, I've still got about 5 subquests left.
Jeez.
So I'll probably hit 43 or so. I mean, if you're not completely and utterly ridiculous about time-consuming gameplay like I am, and also, to be fair, I was under the pressure of a review time. Mm-hmm. This game can easily set you back a month. I mean, I was averaging about 5 hours a day, which is really freaking high for a game if you work.
Speaking of, actually, James, you mentioned a few weeks ago, you used the term breaking the seal on Ogre Battle 64 when we did it for Retroactive. This week, I can't even remember the exact moment when I decided to start playing Picross again.
Oh, God.
There's just not that much more left for me to do, I think, but holy crap, that has to be, I mean, at $20, that has to be the cheapest narcotic ever released on an unsuspecting public.
Well, crack back in the 80s was pretty cheap.
Yeah, but that lasts like a day. Picross 3D is hundreds of hours of obsession. Anyway, Well, man, I would love to be playing Radiant Historia. My problem is I want to play that and Dragon Quest VI, and I'm tempted very foolishly to get one of those reduced price PSPs so I can play Tactics Ogre and a bunch of other stuff, and I'm not going to do any of that stuff right now.
Well, if you do all of those things, at the very least, I can no longer be made fun of for playing a lot of RPGs.
No, yeah. Right now, I'm focusing more on just small things because I have so many of them that I want to get through. I mean, I bought Beyond Good and Evil HD this week and Vagrant Story because they finally released Vagrant Story on PlayStation Network, and I've never played it. And I've always heard amazing things about it. So it was like $6. Okay.
That was one of the perfect score games, wasn't it, from Famitsu back when that was rare?
Yeah. And people just talk about it like it's incredible.
It's supposed to be amazing, and I've always wanted to play it, and it's...
Well, you can now.
Well, no, I can't.
Oh, that's right. You have an Xbox.
And I won't. Because I hate that. Sony.
Didn't Xenogears come out the week before? It's like really weird.
Yeah.
They've been sitting on this pile of RPGs for the American PSN for years, and then they get two in a couple of weeks.
We're not worried about that. We'll give you guys Flintstones Bowling. Enjoy that instead.
Well, speaking of sitting on RPGs, Greg, do you have some news from Japan?
Yeah, so it's time for some notes on Japan Virtual Console. It's been a while since I've said this. Not that it's slowed down a lot than it was, you know, a few years ago. But March is going to be a milestone because it's finally going to hit 600 games in Japan, the service, which puts it at more than 50% bigger than the American service at 380, I think it is, at the minute. But amongst the number of games that have been announced coming out during March, is Final Fantasy VI, so they are actually going to put that on Virtual Console before it gets what we've always considered to be some sort of inevitable deluxe remake for 3DS, PSP, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So that is going to complete the promise that was made, given that it's GDC week this week. 2 years ago, they announced that they were going to release all of these Final Fantasy games on Virtual Console. It's finally happening.
To be fair, they had a lot more to get through in Japan.
They did.
Whereas in the US, they had three. With Mystic Quest, we'll say four.
Three and a half. I will not let you give that a full
three
one.
And a half. I like Mystic Quest, but
you get
yeah.
to throw hatchets. I mean, come on.
I mean, this is great news for us Western gamers, because I think once FF6 is out in Japan, they will start to process it for release in Europe and North America as Final Fantasy III.
Yeah, the Final Fantasy III version is probably a few months away or something in the Western territories. Of course, that did not come out in Europe, much like Final Fantasy IV.
Really? It never came out in Europe?
Well, on the Super Nintendo. It came out on the portable re-release stuff, but...
Oh, wow. So you guys will get an import, hopefully.
So, yeah, that'll be a 900-point game, you know, Super Nintendo with the premium.
Oh, it's worth it.
That means, of course, for me, if I was interested in playing, because I've never played Final Fantasy VI, that when it's on the PAL Virtual Console, it won't be a bad PAL version. So...
Oh, that's right.
It'll pass my purity tests and be playable.
Oh, Greg, let me tell you, dude, Final Fantasy III/6 is one of my all-time favorite games.
It is the
shit.
A lot of people say so, and you know, I would like to try it. So ideally, I'd kind of like to try it portably. I had so much fun replaying Chrono Trigger portably that, you know, I kind of feel like I would like to do it that way. But, yeah, I'm sure I could chip away at it over a longer period when it makes it to the import PAL Virtual Console, because, of course, the Japanese version isn't going to do me any good, as nice as it is that's coming out this month. But, funnily enough, go back to PSN. Just as Japan Virtual Console is about to cross this milestone, I actually found out last week that Japan's PlayStation Archives has already exceeded 600 games. So it shows you how that has really accelerated with things like PC Engine's come to it, Neo Geo, and they've just cranked out more and more stuff recently. It's actually, you know, it's quite the opposite to the Virtual Console. It seems to be increasing with big name titles like, you know, those big RPGs, and the Parasite Eve games came out to coincide with the third birthday and all this
stuff.
Well,
yeah, but you know why, right?
PSP, remote play.
Because, you can buy those on your PS3. And then transfer them and play them on your PSP. Actually, I think you can buy them straight off your PSP as well.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, so that's why it's big in Japan.
And the PSP is a big deal there, so that's kind of shows the... it'll be interesting to see how the 3DS eShop could kind of tap into a similar sort of phenomenon, if at all. Now, in terms of what I've been playing, I've finished Professor Layton and the Lost Future, which is very entertaining. The ending was every bit as mental as I'd been led to believe. But I was surprised at one point where the narrative sort of veered into what I could only think of as there's something about Mary territory. Now, before anyone gets any ideas that are a bit more depraved, I mean that in the sense that
there's something about Luke.
Every adult male character in the story was apparently in love with the same woman.
Yes.
So I was half expecting Brett Favre to come in at the end trump everyone. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. But yeah, it was great getting back into Layton after all these years. And it's so curiously compelling stuff once you get going.
I do love that they have continued their ridiculous ending streak, though.
There is, with the release of the 3DS game in Japan now, there's another two games out there. I can only imagine, like, because you've got to make it bigger, you've
got
to escalate.
Yeah, I mean, you've got, right. At some point, there's going to be like, well, actually, the entire city was fake. It was a soundstage being beamed down from holographic projectors on Hindenburgs.
But the only kind of the new acquisition I've been playing is a bit of a weird one, this, but there was an import sale that I took advantage of to buy for a Japanese Wii, Bleach versus Crusade. Now, this is the other treasure Wii game, apart from Sin of Punishment. So they made a couple of fine games on DS, which I've got the second one of those, and I really quite like that. It's very well executed. But this game for Wii is rather different, to say the least. So it's a sort of a 3D arena combat kind of thing, but you've got like a tag team Marvel versus Capcom style mechanic with two characters, and you've got a variety of control schemes, one of which I can only imagine is somewhat similar to Castlevania Judgment. In that there is there is like a kind of melee attack map to wiggling the Wii remote around. So yeah, I haven't dabbled with that very much, but it's classic controller, fully supported, in which case there was classic controller Judgment as well, right?
But the game was designed around Waggle, so it was so simplified and shallow.
It certainly doesn't seem that
one
way here.
One-to-one Simon Belmonting was not included.
It doesn't seem that way here. You've got melee attacks mapped to the right analog stick, basically, is what you've got. So, you know, you can have an upward thrust across or a down thrust with swords. I mean, that works fine on the classic controller. But it's a weird kind of fighting. I haven't played anything like this before.
You can run around in the 3D arena?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of like Power Stone. It's a little bit like T'Ball. Nobody played T'Ball.
A lot of these games that I've kind of somewhat heard it compared to, I haven't played.
Is it more like Power Stone or is it more like Soul Calibur?
Oh, it's not much like Soul Calibur, let's put it that way.
Okay.
Because I have played that.
So you can freely run in any direction.
Yeah. I mean, you're locked on to, okay, you're like as if it was in a third-person action game, where you like a Zelda game where you're holding down Zed or whatever. Yeah, you're locked on to a character by default, but you are running around in a 3D space. And some of these levels are quite expansive and have a certain amount of... some of them are just flat, but some of them have, certain obstacles or different terrain in them.
There are actually a couple of N64 games in that style. I wonder if any of you guys remember these. They were both made by the company Sapphire. The first one's called BioFreaks.
Oh boy.
I know that I remember the name. It doesn't have the best connotations in my mind.
It shouldn't.
And then they made a kind of licensed sequel to it called Xena Warrior Princess,
yes.
The Talisman of Fate. I think, well, BioFreaks is a great idea. It's just kind of sloppily made.
Say nothing positive about that Xena game, please.
Oh, I thought it was fun. Sorry. I rented it. I thought it was fun.
It's dreadful.
It was a long time ago.
I'll bring the cartridge to PAX East if you don't believe me. It's dreadful.
God. We were all younger then.
It would actually be kind of fun to sit around and look at that thing.
It's abysmal.
BioFreaks was fun because all your characters had these, the environments, the arenas were just gigantic and they were really multi-tiered, so you could jump and fly around a lot and there were a lot of projectile attacks. It wasn't so much like a traditional fighting game because you were mostly shooting guns and like throwing energy shots at each other.
I think this is probably closer to a normal fighting game than that. I mean, the environments aren't that wacky, but it's an interesting tension. Because you have got this pretty big play field to deal with. And so I guess the tendency may be to use projectile attack. Everyone's got pretty much, I mean, there's a good variation in the characters. Of some are a lot faster than others and will cover ground a lot quicker and things like that. But a lot of people have got projectile attacks. So you could say, well, let's just kind of fire at each other from range. But the thing is, those are actually quite easily blocked. You scarcely even really have to do anything to block them. If you just kind of stand in a neutral position, you're not really doing anything. You just absorb them and it doesn't hurt you. Although there's a limit to that. Like, if you absorb too much, if you just kind of stood there doing nothing, you just kind of turtled, eventually get overwhelmed. I guess a bit like, the Smash Brothers bubble block shield, way it shatters after a while. But the thing is, that kind of encourages you to come closer to one another, and that's where it could get really lethal, because you could get caught in a melee combo, and there's not a whole lot you could do to get out of them, apart from maybe calling in your partner character for an assist. So it's a weird sort of push and pull situation where, you won't necessarily get a whole lot done from range, but there's quite a lot of risk if you come in close. So I haven't necessarily kind of come to grips with all the ramifications of that yet. I mean, just playing through some of the one player content to unlock stuff is very, very easy. There is some sort of story mode, not too dissimilar to the one that's in the DS game, although it just seems a lot simpler. Just banging through, reams of Japanese text, winning a fight, and I find that I've unlocked stuff, which is fine by me. I'm quite happy for it to be really easy to unlock things rather than having to play through the game on very hard or whatever, like some of these fighting games are. So yeah, it's a bit strange. I mean, visually it's a bit rough but quite attractive. It's got a cel shaded style, as you might expect for an anime game, and there's some quite spectacular stuff with the super attacks, and you get some completely outlandish ones where you turn into like a giant cephalopod and has like death rays and stuff. It's where it kind of puts the 3D expanse to use a bit. So obviously it's quite a bit different from what I normally enjoy from Treasure, but I was willing to take a risk on it for a sort of low price. And I mean, it's different. I'll certainly give it that. One thing about it does have online, which I'll never use.
Are you playing it locally then?
Yeah, I'm playing it locally, which is weird because of the nature of the game is it has to be split screen. Because you're this whole thing of being like locked on, that wouldn't really work if you were sharing the same view. So it's split, but this game is begging for a vertical split option on widescreen. Absolutely begging for it. And obviously it's in Japanese, so it's kind of difficult to be definitive. But through exhaustive research from message boards and things, it seems it does not have one, which is pretty annoying because a horizontal split of a widescreen display in this case is pretty unsuitable. But I've had I've had a little bit of fun with it in two players so far. I hope to sort of keep at it. But I don't think there is much chance of this coming out anywhere. I mean, I'm not really familiar with all this stuff, but there's some question of when the anime in the US catches up, maybe they'll release it because, the story that's featured in the game is ahead of where the translated versions are.
They've done that with the Naruto games a couple times, where they just waited.
It's my understanding that this particular series has like 800,000 episodes, though. So, I mean, who knows how far behind they are.
Yeah, and I mean, there's an issue of the commercial viability of it by the time they do catch up or something. Because, I mean, it's already more than 2 years old. It came out at the end of 2008, round about the time that I got my Japanese Wii. So I've had my eye on it for quite a while just because it's made by Treasure. Mm-hmm. And, it got some favorable coverage from like TGS and stuff before pretty much then like nothing was written about it because apparently nobody bought it. I mean, I think it's between Disaster and Captain Rainbow in the halls of ignominy of Japanese Wii sales.
Three awesome titles.
I was just thinking, Greg, when you were describing the horizontal split screen on a widescreen TV, I wonder if you can do that in GoldenEye. If you did, would you have like the the widest field of vision ever.
I think I've only played GoldenEye 2 play with the vertical split.
Which would make, I mean, that would make the most sense, because then essentially each one of you has approximately a square screen. You know, it seems like it would be conducive, but I was just thinking, if you did use a horizontal split screen and you had a 16:9 television in a first-person shooter, wouldn't that just give you this completely unnaturally wide field of vision?
Yeah, panoramic. Yeah. The problem is like, you know, if your head is just somewhat tilted to the floor, you're effectively blind to anything in the corridor.
Right. Okay, now, John, did you have any new business this week?
Not too much new business. Of course, I've been playing some more Killzone 3 with the Move controller, which is really, really good. I'm actually really enjoying it, particularly for online. I think since, you know, my short take on it, pretty much if you're a crappy player online, Move will definitely make you better, just because, much like the keyboard mouse setup for first-person shooters, it decouples where you're aiming from where you're moving, which is kind of one of the drawbacks of using a controller, where you're effectively lining up an X and Y axis, and that's where you shoot and move for the most part. But yeah, definitely, I mean, I have no desire to even play it with a DualShock at all.
I'm surprised.
It's much better than I thought it would be, to be perfectly honest.
That's great news.
But yeah, anyways, also, Zach and I had a chance to hook up for... No, we did not have a chance to hook up, James, as much as you would love that. Yeah, we got to play some Call of Duty Black Ops DS online, which is always an interesting experience. And I must say, it's probably the pickiest game I've ever seen in terms of how you have to have your router set up in order to get it to work. Because Zach and I were just trying to do a simple one-person host a game. I mean, just a one-on-one deathmatch game, just to see kind of what it played like. But yeah, it was impossible. I mean, we just had so many problems getting, you know, network issues. We kept getting, like, the error of doom, which is, like, something like 86420. That's what you get when you just cannot connect. And the thing is, you go to Nintendo's support site, and it just says, this error occurs when two players cannot connect with each other. Check your firewalls. I was like, well, that's awesome.
God, this is like flashbacks of 5 years ago, Metroid Prime Hunters, and the Nintendo USB dongle thing for me.
Piece of shit.
Yeah, and so, I mean, it got to the point where, like, I was like, this game is not worth the effort to try to get it working, but at the same time, I was like, I've already put this much time in, I might as well figure out what the hell's going on. And so, from what I can figure out...
The damage was done.
Well, I think the problem was on my end, because the way I have my router set up is that I have a whole bunch of like port forwarding rules that assign like my PS3 and 360's network ports to, you know, I have them set on certain ports. A long time ago, I was looking for like the optimum ports to use, and this was back when, you know, especially PSN, when PSN was kind of crappy and up and down like in terms of connectivity. And so, you know, there was kind of like a list of optimum ports to use. Like,
I love that there was a list of optimum ports at one point.
Yeah, you know how this stuff is. People try to, like, you know, figure out exactly what's going on a company's, you know, network. And
no, guys, it's 6091.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so I have all these port forwarding rules. And so I was trying to make, I mean, this is probably partially with my router as well. I was trying to set up a rule that was just like a wide open rule. Even if I unchecked everything, I couldn't set it this way. But I think that what Black Ops is doing is, I think it just picks a port at random.
Oh, perfect.
And because I had all these rules set up, I couldn't do that, and it was just so annoying. So I wound up like setting a certain range of ports open, and finally, and so it would connect like once out of every five times, because I think it just randomly picked a port in that range. So we sat there for like 2 hours trying to get it to work. So finally we got it to work, and it's pretty good. You know, the engine is really smooth. I was really surprised. Zach, I think he wasn't too impressed with the way, like, aiming down sights, because you click on an icon to, like, aim down the sights of your gun. And I think his opinion, he didn't like that too much playing the one-player game, but I think his opinion kind of changed, like, being able to play somebody else, because there's not that, you're not dealing with, you know, computer AI, which probably kills you a lot faster than I could when I'm sitting there scrambling to, like, touch this icon and on the touch screen to reload a gun and do this and do that. I mean, the way the controls are set up is there's a whole bunch of icons. Like, you have an icon for your primary gun, your secondary gun, and there's an icon to, like, you know, climb up something. There's an icon to reload, an icon to aim down your sights. And so you're just sitting here, like, clicking on icons, and, you know, the left button shoots. So it's pretty awkward.
Yeah, and by the way, you aim on the touchscreen too.
Yes.
I played, I think I reviewed Call of Duty 3 on the DS or something like that.
And yeah.
I had similar problems where, and this is, I think all of the in-space first-person shooters are like this. They do have a nice engine, but the input leaves something to be desired because there is a hell of a lot of, basically you're aiming by scratching all over the touchscreen, and then when you need to do something, you have to actually look down at the screen and then lift the stylus and tap on a certain place.
Yeah.
But also, if you don't keep the stylus pressed down to the screen perfectly, if it ever comes up and it comes back down, it's likely to come back down on an icon, which means you'll use a grenade when you didn't want to or whatever.
On your feet.
It's very frustrating.
Well, with the gun icons, a lot of times they have one on the left and one on the right, and a lot of times, like the gun icons, you can't really tell which gun is which. You know, it's like, is that a machine gun? Because there's a lot of guns, like, I mean, like something like a submachine gun or an Uzi or something like that, versus, you know, a large, a really long machine gun or a shotgun. You can tell, but it's like shotgun versus a normal machine gun, you know. You can't really tell the difference because the icons look almost identical.
And also, you shouldn't really have to be looking at that for very long to... You shouldn't really have to think about it because you might need to do that very fast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just a genre that just really doesn't work on the DS. I don't think it really ever has. I can't think of a game that's really done it well. Metroid Prime Hunters was okay, but...
the beta.
It's just, it's a genre that, at very best, can be shoehorned onto the hardware.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you think 3DS will do better? I mean, obviously it has the control pad, which... I mean, the circle pad, which... I think hopefully they'll feel comfortable using the D-pad below that for buttons, you know, for maybe switching weapons and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't know, because, I mean, it seems like at best they could do something like they did on the PSP with first-person shooters.
Yeah.
Which is serviceable, is about as best I can do.
I think you need to adapt the game design to what you're dealing with. You
exactly.
Know, the problem with these Call of Duties in particular, I mean, even, you know, I mean, they had some of the same problems with Prime Hunters, but the issue is, you know, when you're dealing with something that is supposed to be a portable version of a console game, it's going to try and have a lot of the trappings. So, yeah, it is going to be primary weapons, secondary weapons, aimed head sights, all these different options which don't necessarily lend themselves to the limitations of the interface that you have there. So, I mean, if you had an original shooter, or at least, you know, something in an established IP that was willing to be a bit more daring and streamline the design, I think you could come up with something good.
Yeah.
But is the demand there? Well, it certainly isn't going to come from Japan, and hitherto it's not really been demonstrated it's all that strong on portables in the Western markets either.
Nope. I mean, I don't think there has been any demand for first-person shooters. Just because it's just not a good experience on portables up to this point.
And I think part of it is probably because that's such a genre driven by, I mean, to be honest, graphic horrorism. That having
Well, because it's first person, I mean, immersion is a big factor, and, you know, portable gaming is not that strong in that category because, you know, you're not going to have the big screen, the
right.
big set, surround sound.
It's about putting it on your 57-inch plasma.
And in terms of online connectivity, you know, that's become a very, very big part of the most modern shooters, and obviously, you know, you've got all sorts of issues in terms of performance and accessibility.
Yeah. Right. Especially that particular brand. I mean, that brand itself is driven by its online gameplay.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's just the type of, like, high performance. All of the areas in which first-person shooters typically are demanded to be high performance or high performing, they do not translate to portables at all.
Right. But, I mean, the portable gameplay mechanic is more 2D focused. I mean, it just is.
And also, it lends itself to more laid back sorts of things. I've enjoyed something like Contra 4.
Yeah,
on
I was
going to
actually mention the Konami games. It's like, whoa.
But at the same time, you know, Contra 4 was never going to spend as much time in my DS as, you know, something like Picross, because, you know, I could easily play on the train and anywhere else here quite happily.
You couldn't play Contra 4 on the train and not be arrested for profanity?
I could if I wanted to look at the game over screen quite a lot.
Damn it!
Yeah, so I mean, it'll be interesting to see kind of what, I mean, in terms of first-person shooters on portables, I think it's a genre that could work on portables. I mean, I think Sony's, you know, NGP or whatever it's going to be called may work, but again, that thing's price, I mean, it's going to be a niche portable anyways.
At least in the beginning.
And it's still going to have the issue of, yes, it's a much closer approximation with dual analog sticks and the quality of the graphics and the lovely screen and all that, but it's still going to be the sort of junior version, the inferior version, and it's still not going to be on your big theater setup.
Well, and it's going to have to be done over Wi-Fi.
Right.
It's not going to be done over 3G.
That's where I was going. It's going to be, the online play is still going to be an issue there.
Guys, I have to defend immersion. Because the idea that you need a 57-inch TV and surround sound to be immersed in something is ludicrous. I have been immersed in paperback books that are no bigger than a DS, and it didn't have sound at all.
High-def paperback books, to be clear.
It comes down to the quality of the experience. Immersion is not a technical thing. It's a creative thing. And these games, maybe they're not immersive because they're not. They're just not that interesting.
Yeah, there's always making it better, but the point is that if you're going to match up one with the other, that if you've got essentially the same content on one platform and another, then it's the edge goes to that.
You're right there.
When picking your platform, that is always going to be one in the column for consoles, along with the online and all that. So it's not that it can't be.
It just can't rely on flash, bang. It can't rely on loudness and spectacle. It has to actually get your attention through what it's doing.
But see, that's not what the first-person shooter genre is right now. The first-person shooter genre right now is guide you from scripted event to scripted event where shit blows up.
Well, that's changed before, and it will change again.
What evidence do we have to say it's going to change again? But the fact that every version of Call of Duty sells more than the last one?
Activision will drive that series into the ground.
Yep, they will.
Well, they're not putting out 4 a year, so No,
as I said in the beginning with relation to interface, I mean, if people are willing to build something to the strengths of a portable system, I think you could have a good, worthwhile experience. But the problem is just that it's not yet demonstrated that the market for that exists. So whoever would do that would be taking something of a risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, and these games are never the lead platform for the handheld versions.
No, not as it currently stands.
Well, Greg was right to bring up Metroid Prime Hunters before, because that game was developed specifically for the DS. There's no console version of it. And I think that game works better as a handheld game than a lot of these Call of Duty ports do, because it tries to do less. You don't have 18 guns to flip through. You don't have grenades. Mm-hmm. Basically, the touchscreen is aiming, and I think there's one button to flip into the morph ball. And that's it. And it works better because they're not trying to cram 15,000 things onto the touchscreen.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. So anyway, we got to move on. We got to wrap up new business, but we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have your listener mail. Welcome back to the show. We now have a very special segment for you. We've got Matt Walker on the line. Hey, Matt.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
It's been quite a while since we had Matt on the show. I think it was TGS 2009, so we're very happy to have you back. And Matt is over in Tokyo, or thereabouts, and he's going to tell us all about his shiny new 3DS. So also on the line, of course, Greg Leahy and James Jones.
Hello.
No, hoy.
John is possibly still at work. We're not sure. We're recording this separately from the rest of the show because we did want to cater to Matt, since he's got a 14-hour time difference.
16.
Yeah, 16 for you, 14 for James.
Yeah. It's very confusing. It's a different day where Matt is.
Well, it's a different day where Greg is, too, to be fair. I mean...
Yeah, just about.
Yeah, we do appreciate you being here, Matt. So, first off, I wondered if you could give us just a very quick story of what your experience was like picking up the 3DS on launch day. Did you have a pre-order?
Yeah, I had a pre-order. Luckily, my wife, obviously I have to work a day job. So my wife went and pre-ordered it for me the day that the Bic Camera, which is one of the electronic stores in Japan, had decided to put out their pre-orders. So she went and lined up, and actually she had a bigger line for the pre-orders than I had when I went to actually purchase the system with my pre-order. they had the line like going up the stairs of the place, and it's that building's probably 14 floors, something like that, at over 10 floors. And she had to line up to the top of the 7th floor, whereas I lined up when I picked it up to the 5th floor, I think, 4th or 5th floor. So, yeah, I guess everybody knew that, you know, they had to get their pre-order if they wanted the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the morning that it was released, what was it, last Saturday,
mm-hmm.
I walked over there, and actually there's another electronic store right across the street called Lobby. And I think we mentioned in a story on the site that allegedly the line for that at Lobby was like over 700 people. But I guess that they actually had some 3DSs aside from what was pre-ordered, so that's probably why.
Mm-hmm.
But I just walked over to Big Camera, and at about 10 o'clock, I got in line at the 5th floor, and by 10:30, I was out with my 3DS and Super Street Fighter 4, so pretty awesome.
Very efficient. So, and then your life was changed forever, of course.
Oh, it was, man. It was. I could tell you the 3D and the Shidachi guy, the Street Pass. Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah. Have you gotten much use out of the Street Pass yet?
Actually, I have. In fact, truth be told, that's kind of like what I look forward to the most every time I pick up my system. Because, you know, luckily being in Japan, there's people are walking around all over the place. So if anybody has a 3DS, you definitely get a chance to do the Street Pass with them. And so, you know, I'll get to work and be like, ooh, let's see who, like, for instance, what Miis did I get a chance to exchange with on the way to work. And same as, like, you know, if I go take a walk during my lunch break or when I come home. So, yeah, I really enjoy, you know, picking it up and finding out what the deal is with that. Because they have, so the default way that you can technically do Street Pass is they have the, what is it called, the Mii Hiroba. Hiroba is, like, a big place where you can, people can get together.
Oh, like a plaza.
Yeah, the Mii Plaza.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, exactly. Mii Plaza. There you go. You guys can go ahead and correct me if you know the English names to any of the stuff that I'm saying. Because it's been so long since I've played something in English at this point. So, you know, that's already in the system when you pick it up. And you can turn on the city that you got. You actually have to turn on the Street Pass. Same with Super Street Fighter 4. But you turn that on, and then it will exchange Miis between your system and, you know, whoever else has Street Pass turned on as you walk by them, right? So within this Mii Hiroba, this Mii Plaza, there are two different games that you can play with the Street Pass. One is a puzzle game. So you have different puzzles, and you can, as you collect Miis over Street Pass, they'll have different puzzle pieces. And so you can, whenever you pass somebody, you get a chance to get one puzzle piece from them. So you can, you know, decide which piece you're going to take and take it. And then the other one is a little bit of like a medieval, like RPG motif anyways, where your me is like the king of some kingdom and he gets kidnapped by ghosts. And so the idea is that you get a chance to recruit people that you Street Pass with, and those people come up and they'll basically get one turn to go and fight against these ghosts. And there's a whole bunch of different rooms of ghosts that you have to clear before you get to the king. So I'm about halfway through the first level at this point, and I've been doing it for a week. But the interesting thing is that the only way that you can progress is if you do either Street Pass or you use those game coins.
Oh, from walking around?
Exactly. And unfortunately, with the game coins, you're limited to 10 coins a day, I think. And I think it's, I can't remember if it's like 100 or 100 steps per coin or something to that effect. So you use the game coins, and then you can basically do the same thing that you would do with the Street Pass, where, so if it's in the puzzle game, you'll be able to buy puzzle pieces, random puzzle pieces. Or in the medieval motif game, you can recruit, like, you know, PC players that, you just take one turn to go up against these ghosts in a kind of a RPG battle type fashion. You can either select attack or magic.
Wow.
So now that I've spoken for 5 minutes on end without breath, please go ahead.
I'm fascinated. I had no idea that that game was built into the system. This is actually the first I've heard about it. I haven't read every piece of coverage out there, but the 3DS includes an RPG built into the system. That's surprising.
And it's not an RPG in the sense that, I mean, you know, you're not going to like move over, you know, the overworld map and all that. It's literally just like it kind of shows you this little layout of rooms, and, you know, you have a room that you've gotten to at this point in time, and as you do the Street Pass, then you get one more chance to like hit them one time or use magic on them one time, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So my next question is, I'm sure you were very excited when you went out to the store and you picked this thing up and you took it home. What was the first thing that you did on the 3DS? I mean, aside from the setup.
The setup. And then I basically went through all the settings, and I'm the kind of guy that I like to, before I do anything, like before I play a game, I have to do tutorial modes and that kind of thing. So when I got the 3DS, the first thing I wanted to do was look through all of the settings to find out what I could do and couldn't do. So the big thing I wanted to do was take all the stuff from my DSi and move that over to my 3DS.
Denied.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the first thing I did. And then after that, I think I tinkered around with like the Mii software and all that stuff. Unfortunately, I haven't taken the chance to play AR games or face shooting much partly because I like to just jump right into Street Fighter because I've been a Street Fighter fanboy for years, but also because I don't want to say disorienting, but I don't like the fact that to play those games, you do have to move the 3DS around, you know? Mm-hmm. I kind of like to keep the screen in one place.
So before we get into Street Fighter itself, I'm kind of curious, you've played the game for many hours at this point, right?
Yeah. I've always been a huge Street Fighter fan. And basically, whenever I get a chance to play a new Street Fighter game on a portable system, I go crazy apeshit nuts because I love to play it. And I love to play it like wherever I can. So, for instance, the game that I played on Game Boy Advance more than anything else was when they came out with that Super Street Fighter II Turbo Revival game.
Wow.
That was basically my default game. If there was nothing else playing at the time, I would just pop that in and then go through arcade mode with Ryu on, the hardest level, because that's just what I've always done. So, and that's what I do now on the 3DS. So I've been playing a crap ton and trying to collect all the figures and all that stuff. So
having played it quite a bit, even in the first week, are you actually using the 3D effect when you play the game, or are you turning it off for better frame rate?
I am. In fact, the frame rate is smooth either way. I don't know. I know with Dead or Alive, they were saying that if the 3D is off, then Dead or Alive moves on 60 frames per second, right? With Street Fighter, I'm not sure whether or not it changes, but either way, it's really smooth. I think the guys in the MT Framework team did a great job of porting that over.
So you are playing with 3D on?
Yeah, I am playing with on. I know, I read last night, Brian Ashcraft from Kotaku.
He sworn off the 3D forever.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. He's sick of it, right? And he had some good points of stuff that I haven't had a chance to check out yet. Like, for instance, playing Layton, reading text. I can imagine that reading text would definitely be disorienting, especially having to go between the screens. But I've been playing Street Fighter, and furthermore, I haven't even been playing it in, like, the over-the-shoulder view. I've just been playing it straight on. So I've had no problems with it all. I've been playing it all in 3D, and sometimes I'll experiment with it a little bit and turn the 3D down to about halfway. But even now, when I have it up all the way, I don't get disoriented at all or anything like that. As far as like losing the effect goes, I know some people have mentioned that they kind of lose the effect. I noticed that it's more pronounced at certain times depending on how I'm focusing on the game, but I've never really lost the effect so much. Of course, there's the sweet spot. And so turning the system, you can clearly see that I'm not entirely sure about the technology, but turning the screen, you can clearly see that, what is it?
Parallax barrier?
Yes.
Yes, exactly. The parallax barrier, like, it clearly switches over to the other eye. What should be shown to the right eye is being shown to the left eye. So, you do notice that you do have to keep it pretty straight sometimes in order to play the game in general. But one interesting thing I found was that if you shut your left eye or if you shut your right eye, you can clearly tell that you have two different pictures being shown. It's really interesting. Like, looking at that Mii Hirobaa I was talking about, if you look at it with both eyes open, you can see the Mii facing you, right? Facing straight at you. But if you close your left eye, you can see that the Mii is facing to the right a little bit. And then if you close your right eye, you can see that the Mii is facing to the left a little bit.
Yeah, that makes sense with how the technology works. So have you found that the 3D effect, does it bother you over a long, if you sit down and play the game for, I don't know if you've played it for like 2-3 hours at a time, but if you do, does that bother you after a while?
Oh yeah, I've played it for crap. I think last weekend I probably played it for 4 or 5 hours straight, and then even last night, coming home from Osaka, at a business trip where the Shinkansen, the bullet train ride is 2.5 hours long, played the whole time, and I have not yet gotten disoriented, but again, it could be because I'm playing Street Fighter. I would really like to try out, like, for instance, Professor Layton. I remember I went to that Nintendo. I don't know if it was Space World, but that event in January, right?
Yeah, the Nintendo World.
Yeah, Nintendo World. And I had a chance to try out, at that point in time, I tried out Street Fighter, Pilot Wings, Kid Icarus. I think it might have been just those three. But what I found to be the most disorienting was Pilot Wings at the time. And I thought that had something to do with perhaps the fact that there is a much greater depth of field in that game.
Yeah.
And so at the time, I remember thinking that I would, you know, focus my eyes on one thing, and it was a bit disorienting for me to notice that there were other things that my eyes weren't focusing on. And when I first got the system, I noticed that with Street Fighter as well, but then I realized that if I had turned the 3D down to about halfway, I didn't get that disorienting feeling at all. So I don't know. I really look forward to playing Pilot Wings again and getting a chance to kind of turn the 3D up and down and play with it and see if, you know, that has any difference on whether or not I get disoriented.
Well, I would think that the backgrounds in Street Fighter don't have nearly enough, they don't have nearly as much depth to them as they would in Pilot Wings, just because in Pilot Wings you are looking over the shoulder into a very large open environment that you can fly through, whereas in Street Fighter, especially if you're playing it, you know, on the normal side view, the backgrounds...
Right, it's a fighting game versus a flying game.
It's not a humongous environment that these characters are fighting in necessarily.
Yeah, that's quite a possibility. And so, yeah, I really look forward to playing the game. I'm really sad that we didn't get Pilot Wings for launch here, because I would have been all over that.
Yeah, so it first couple of weeks of April now, isn't it? So a little bit after the Western launches, I think it's coming out in Japan.
That's sad. That makes me sad. The reason I moved to Japan to begin with was so that I could get games of four people in the West.
You get jobbed on, was it New Super Mario Brothers was a bit after in Japan, wasn't it, or something?
Yeah, I think it was.
But I was interested to hear that the battery life seems to have held up quite well if you're playing it for hours at a time on the bullet train. How have you found that part of it?
Well, I mean, I'm used to, like, you know, having like an iPhone, for instance. And so I know right away that, you know, in order to get the best battery life out of something, you turn the brightness on the screen down as much as possible and you turn off all the features you don't need, right? So the system, I think when you boot it up for the first time, it just comes default to like with the max brightness.
Oh, yeah, it does. I know personally from the XL, I turned it on and my face melted a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So there's things I'd like to test out, but I have a feeling that perhaps the 3D is a little easier or more pronounced, maybe easier to see with the brightness up. But I, you know, turn the brightness down to about 3, and then if I know I'm going to be going on a long trip, I turn it down to maybe about 2.
Could you change the brightness on the fly like you can with the DSi?
Yeah, you can. You bring up the home screen, and then in the top left corner is an icon for the brightness.
Right.
Greg is forgetting that with a home screen, you can do everything on the fly.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
It's nice.
Right.
Although you will be able to bring up the internet browser from that actually provide that in the May update.
Yep. From the home screen, you can also pull up, like, let's see here. You can pull up your notifications. You can pull up your buddy list. You can pull up the game memo function.
Yes.
And then, as I had mentioned at one point in time, you can decide on how many rows of icons you're going to have on the home screen.
That's kind of nice. I wish I could do that on the Wii.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
Is the notes function as useful as in my mind I envision it being? I kind of see it like something that you could really quickly get into and make your notes quickly. Is it that easy?
It's that easy to get into it, but I'll be honest, I haven't actually tried it yet. Like,
yeah, I mean, you don't really need it for Street Fighter, I guess.
exactly. Yeah, I'm not gonna pause the system and then, like, you know, write down some combo, because I'm probably going to memorize that combo before I actually go and try to use it.
Have you been finding D-pad versus circle pad with relation to Street Fighter?
Oh man, that's been my biggest thing as far as control on Street Fighter goes, because I've always been a D-pad guy to begin with. I've never been a joystick guy, because I started playing Street Fighter on the Super NES, right, all those years ago. And I just got accustomed to using the D-pad. When I started playing like Street Fighter Alpha on the PlayStation, I was always making sure to use the D-pad. And then as games came out for Dreamcast and PS2, again, it was always the D-pad. So I was used to that to begin with. But it's so uncomfortable to play a fighting game on that D-pad because it's so low on the system.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a matter of, okay, well, how do I grip the system so that I have, you know, a good firm grip on it without, I know I'm not going to drop it, and I know I can keep it in a good place so that I can focus on doing this input. And at first I had a bit of trouble with that because it just wasn't comfortable for me when I needed this really precise input. But So I tried out using the circle pad, and the circle pad was more comfortable to use, but I realized that I had to have my hand in a very specific orientation to know exactly, you know, what input I was going to be accurately putting in. A lot of times what ended up happening was if I had my hand in the wrong place or in the wrong rotation even, my input would be rotated. So for instance, if I tried to do down, down, forward, forward, it would come out in the system as, for instance, down, back, down, down, forward. And so I couldn't pull off, like, you know, Hadouken.
Do you think that's because the circle pad doesn't have the notches in it like Nintendo usually does?
I don't know. That's a good question. Again, I've never really been, like, a, you know, stick guy on fighting games on the home systems. And I know I've had similar problems on home systems, but this is the first time that, you know, it's been an issue because for every other home system I've played, the D-pad is in a pretty comfortable position. I can just worry about using the D-pad. I'm not entirely sure why, but it does make me a little sad that, you know, I have this problem to begin with, because if I was maybe a little smarter with the circle pad and I knew what I was doing, then chances are I wouldn't have to worry about it at all, because the circle pad feels good. It feels really good.
Yeah, I wonder if the whole rotation thing about, you know, having your hand in the right place or moving it in the cardinal directions when you want to instead of the diagonal directions, I wonder if that will get better over time as basically our muscle memory adapts to holding that thing.
I sure hope so, but I mean, the big thing to keep in mind here is that because it's Street Fighter, you're not really sure what direction you're pushing in at any point in time. If you're playing, like, for instance, like, you know, Mario 64 or something to that effect, right away, whenever you press a direction, you can see what direction Mario is going in.
Oh, so you can correct yourself.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Whereas with Street Fighter, you really have no idea what the system is thinking you're hitting. Mm-hmm. And so really to find out what the heck was going on, because I first started playing it, you know, I jacked up the difficulty 8 to 8 because that's what I've always played it on. And I just keep getting my ass kicked. And like, I'm like, you know, I cannot pull a Shoryuken off to save the life of me. So I ended up going to training mode to take a look at the inputs to find out, okay, what am I doing wrong? And that's when I saw that basically, that's when I realized that depending on the orientation of my hand on the device, my input was getting rotated.
Very interesting. Yeah, so maybe that'll only be an issue on certain kinds of games. And even then, it seems like something you might be able to adapt to, but it would probably take quite a while. And I mean, you, because this is a port and you already know this game really well, you know, I wouldn't really expect you to try to learn to play that way, since you obviously you're going in expecting to play at a certain level already.
Right, exactly. It's just what I'm used to. So it's good that I do have the choice of the D-pad. But yeah, this could be a completely personal thing too, you know. I mean, there's probably plenty of other fighting game fans out there that are used to using an analog stick and they could pull everything off just fine.
What about the feel of the rest of the buttons? Are they pretty much the same as your DSi?
Yeah, they feel good. Actually, The D-pad itself is a little, it's not sticky, but there's something about it. I noticed that when I rotate from down to up in the left direction, that it actually kind of creaks a little bit. So I don't know if that's, you know, a thing with my system. I hope it is, because that would be a really strange defect for people to have. But the other buttons, they feel pretty good. The only thing is that I had a DSi, and I really didn't play it a whole lot. But when I did play, though, I played the hell out of it. And the thing was that, for some reason, the R button on that system kept getting broken.
Yeah, you hear that. You hear that quite a lot, actually, with DSIs, for whatever reason.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, I bought this system back in America, and my receipts and everything are back in America. So, if you can't use the R button, like, for instance, one of my other go-to games is I just play Mario Kart all the time. And so if you can't, you know, jump in Mario Kart with the R button, then you're really screwed, right? So I sent the DSi to Nintendo once and got it fixed, but they sent me a message back saying, okay, we're going to do this for you, but understand that next time, if you don't have your, you know, receipts or anything like that, we're not going to do it for you. So at first I was like, all right, well, you know, they fixed it. It's cool. But now it's broken again, actually. And I haven't done anything with the system. I keep it in, like, you know, a nice little case just to make sure that nothing happens to it. And so the 3DS, the L and R buttons feel the same as the DSi. So I really hope that, you know, these buttons aren't as defective as the DSi, because I don't want to have to deal with that. Other than that, I've only ever had really good experiences with the quality of Nintendo systems. So it was pretty big shock when I got the DSi and that happened.
By the way, if you register your system on Club Nintendo, you should not ever need a receipt to get a repair.
Oh, okay.
Because that's your proof of purchase, basically, because there's only one code. So if you bought the system used, you wouldn't get the code, so you couldn't register it.
And that makes sense because, you know, I bought the system and registered it in America, right?
But and they would know when you registered it. So that would be essentially become your purchase date.
And actually, we've had members of the forum confirm this who work in retail. They know what store sold what system on what day. Like, wow, and not just like what chain, but like what location.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So, Matt, I have one last question for you before we let you go. Have you shown the 3DS to a lot of other people, and what do they think of it when they see it?
I've had people at work kind of like take a look at it, and they haven't really said much about it. But then again, they're the kind of people that would know. I would show my wife, but she gets motion sickness really easily, especially from 3D. So I think when something comes out on it that piques her interest, we'll turn the 2D down, turn it down to 2D, and she'll end up playing it that way. But she hasn't really taken a look at it. So, yeah, I guess the answer is I really haven't shown it to anybody that, you know, hasn't already seen it.
And you haven't had, like, people on the train come over and ask you about it? I don't know, maybe people in Japan just don't do that, but I feel like if I had a 3DS in America and I was playing it on the bus or on a plane, somebody would probably come over and, you know, want to check it out.
Yeah, I think what would happen in Japan in that case is that a Japanese person would kind of look at it from afar. But because it looks so much like a regular DS, I bet you a lot of people just assume I'm just playing DS because, you know, you get on the train and a ton of people are either playing DS or PSP. It's no big thing. Mm-hmm. Although, I gotta say, I personally think that the selling point of this system, more than the 3D, well, the 3D is gonna be the gimmick that sells it, but I basically agree with Brian Ashcraft from Kotaku that the big thing is the way that they have been implementing this network functionality, you know, and especially like the Street Pass and the Spot Pass, because it's just so much fun to open up the system and find out, you know, what Street Pass data you've collected over the last X number of minutes.
Yeah, I can see that being the case in Japan, but elsewhere remains to be seen how effective that's going to be.
Yeah, just quickly, have you played Street Fighter Online very much, and how does that hold up?
I haven't played it online yet since I don't have internet at home. Yeah, it's a shame.
Well, I guess we know what you're doing right after we stop recording.
Yep, exactly. Gonna have to get a hold of Danny from NWR and see if he's down to play some games.
Actually, I have a question from John.
Okay,
sure.
John sent this via the awesomeness that is text messaging. He wanted to know how the weight of a 3DS compares because he's never actually held one.
I don't think. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think it really feels any much heavier than my DSi. And in fact, yesterday, somebody at work picked it up for the first time and said, wow, this is really light. So, I don't know. I guess my personal opinion is that it feels about the same as a DSi, maybe.
All right. Thank you very much, Matt. We really appreciate you taking your time out and talking to us. And of course, everyone listening can go check out lots of hands-on coverage from both Matt and Danny. Two of our three mans in Japan's and who picked up launch 3DS's. James Charlton actually has some coverage too, but he's waiting until later to get his. But yep, we have quite a bit of coverage of 3DS over at Nintendo World Report. Thanks very much again, Matt.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Alright, first up this week, we've got full-on GDC coverage. Click on the blurry 1980s Iwata photo at the top of our website for a complete guide to our event coverage of the Game Developers Conference. We've got new announcements from Nintendo, including a new Mario game and Netflix on 3DS. And from GDC, Aaron actually already has impressions of Conduit for 3DS. He's one of the very first people to play it, I believe. And you can go check out his thoughts on the portable prequel to High Voltage's Wii first-person shooter franchise.
I got an 8.5 ready for it already, baby.
If it actually ends up existing, John will have that.
Yeah, it's still not officially a game, even though they're already discussing the story.
Yo, it's got 3Ds. I'm pretty sure it's coming out.
Oh, that's awful.
And we've also got a review of Radiant Historia from James Jones himself. You've heard him talk about the DSRPG on this very podcast for the past couple of weeks, and now you can read his complete, detailed review for The Final Word. Guess what? He loves it.
Why?
You might have picked that up in the last few minutes.
Yep.
We have a feature in honor of Black and White's release called The Top 5 Pokemon, which showcases the absolute favorite Pokemon of members of our staff. The series already includes entries from Zach, Pedro, and Josh, and none of them like Mr. Mime, because Mr. Mime is terrible.
Mr. Mime is creepy.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable that was allowed in a children's game. We also have a preview of Super Monkey Ball 3D, which Matt continues our look into the 3DS launch lineup with a preview of Sega's latest Monkey Trapped in a Plastic Ball Simulator franchise. It's a Monkey Ball game which means it's going to come with any launch system.
Next up is that's Extra Life, this one covering Pokemon Puzzle League. The newest entry in our feature series has Josh taking a look back at the beloved N64 adaptation of Panel de Pont, with the added magic, as we've already heard, of Pokemon characters. You can even share his nostalgia by grabbing the game on Virtual Console. And next, we have impressions of LEGO Pirates of the Caribbean. Aaron takes a look at the newest LEGO video game featuring a cuboid, Captain Sparrow. This upcoming 3DS title covers all four of the Pirates movies.
All right, we got Rock Band 3 Squire guitar impressions from Neil. He goes on hand. He goes hands on.
He has
a guitar on hand and goes hands on with Fender's real guitar controller.
Good recovery.
Yeah, like that. Can it really teach you how to play guitar? And is it fun as a game controller? Read his piece and find out these answers. And we have what I suppose should be called Moto Heroes impressions, but I'm going to call them Moto Heroes impressions. Aaron continues his dominance of our site with a look at this WiiWare title from the makers of Trials HD. It's not so much a racing game as a platformer with vehicles.
And Z's.
And lots of Heroes's. Traveling. Neil gives us Traveling Through the Poke City That Never Sleeps. It's his public journal of his experiences playing Pokemon Black and White. In the first few entries, he introduces his starting team of Pokemon.
He picked Oshawott, which is ostensibly the worst starting Pokemon in the history of the franchise.
Yeah, it looks like a little baby clown.
It looks like it needs someone to feed it by hand.
All right, be sure to go check out all of this great original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Alright, it's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We may not be able to answer every email, but we will read them all and we pick out as many as we can to get on the show, like this one from Ganjiness in Saskatchewan, Canada. He writes, I came to your site this afternoon to find out information about Nintendo's GDC announcement. Every other tech news site is covering the iPad 2, and it was really hard to find information about Iwata's GDC keynote. And he goes on to thank us for our coverage. So the question, what do you guys think about Nintendo's future after watching Mr. Iwata's keynote? Well, we can summarize really quickly what he went over. It was really an Iwata/Reggie keynote.
I didn't know Reggie was allowed in the game developer conference. Has he got the requisite credentials?
Yeah,
for that?
Really.
Hey, he invented the Bigfoot pizza, so...
Develop this.
He developed the Bigfoot pizza with his appetite.
Yep.
I can't tell you how many of those I've eaten while playing Super Nintendo in the 90s, so... He has
it's
a
convergence.
Role.
You had media convergence in your gullet.
That's right. So Mr. Iwata made a few announcements about 3DS. He said, well, actually, Reggie made most of the announcements.
You want me to run them down since I was involved in the whole news? All right, so the big one that they did first was that there will be, as we've anticipated, Netflix on 3DS.
Yeah, John had that one in the
prediction. Yep.
You will actually be able to take a video you're streaming on your 3DS and bump it to your Wii and pick up where you left off.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a feature of Wii or 3DS. That's actually, you can do that on any Netflix device.
Can you? With any device going from different devices?
Because the actual server, the Netflix service, keeps track of how much of the movie you've watched.
Gotcha.
So you can watch half a movie on your computer and then go finish it on your PS3. So, yeah. I mean, it's true that it will do that. That's not really an exclusive feature, but it's cool.
They will also have a Nintendo-moderated channel, at least in the U.S., of 3D video content, short form. So this is very similar to what they've got going on in Japan. Mixed types of content. So they mentioned things like comedy and music video stuff. The 3DS will also be able, as Iwata kind of alluded to in one of his Iwata Ask segments, shoot 3D video. They then proceeded to announce that there is a new Mario game, just referred to as Super Mario, for the 3DS, being developed by EAD Tokyo, which is the team that developed the Galaxy games. The logo that they've got so far, which is a working logo, is the Super Mario text from the N64 game with the raccoon tail from Mario 3 attached to the end, which Iwata basically teased, saying that they will have more about that at E3. And the TG, what do they call the TurboGrafx handheld?
It was
TurboExpress.
Yeah. The TurboExpress.
So the TG Express and the Game Gear games will be available on the Virtual Console for the 3DS at launch. Well, both are news that A, they'll be there, and B, they'll be there at launch.
But were there any actual TurboExpress exclusive games, though?
No. So the TurboExpress is a TG16. I mean,
yeah. So they took the same media, the cue cards or whatever they were called. They fit into the TurboExpress just as they fit into the TG16.
It's the same situation as the Nomad, essentially. For those of you who aren't aware, the Nomad was a portable Genesis.
But to be clear, this references the launch of the eShop, which is still in May. At the end of May, they kind of narrowed it down to now.
Right. They also has a little bit of news on Zelda, which is apparent for 3DS, which is apparently slotted to June, Ocarina of Time 3D.
And they showed a trailer for Skyward Sword, which looked pretty much like the stuff from E3 last year.
A little bit more polished. It looked a little bit nicer, graphically speaking.
There were, you know, they showed some new enemies, but I didn't see anything that surprised me that changed my opinion of that game, which is still good.
I think they're still playing it close to the vest up until E3.
Yeah, it wasn't a very shocking trailer. It was good to see more of it.
There were two instances of door opening in the trailer, so I mean, it's not like they were really showing off the highlight of action.
Right.
But I think that's pretty much the extent of his announcements. We got to learn about Iwata circa 1982, which is always interesting.
Which is
awesome. He talked about his start as a programmer and his rivalry with Miyamoto in the early days.
He can make games as good as Miyamoto.
I think his haircut has really come a long way.
Which are the things we learned about Iwata circa 1982.
Yeah, so there was some stuff about 3DS that was expected, but I think the Mario thing is the most interesting out of this. And for me, the cool part is that it's made by EAD Tokyo, because it's their first portable game. I mean, that studio has only existed for about 5 years. So, well, Jungle Beat came out in 2005, so maybe six or 7 years, but they're still fairly new. And they've never made a portable game, so this will be their first one, and they haven't made a 2D game since Jungle Beat.
Well, this isn't a 2D game, so...
Well, we don't know for sure.
Yeah, well, no, because we've seen images of it. It looks like he's moving in 3D.
Well, and I think the biggest clue as to the nature of the gameplay was Iwata mentioning the fact that in 1996, when Mario 64 was being developed and was released, they struggled with the fact, like, well, people are going to find it hard to judge hitting this block in 3D space. So it would be disingenuous to have that as the lead-in to this new Mario title on 3DS, as if it were to solve that problem, and then it just plays like a side-scrolling game.
Well, and that and the fact that they mentioned that they're spending a lot of time developing mechanisms so to use the 3D of the hardware optimally in a platforming game.
Now, it may be rather like Galaxy 2 in that it could segue between, you know, the full free-roaming 3D and, you know, sort of fixed-axis 2D-like bits.
But this is definitely not New Super Mario Bros. 3-D.
No, definitely not, no.
Okay, you guys have effectively burst my bubble. I didn't want New Super Mario Bros. Anything, but I was kind of hoping this would be more along the lines of Jungle Beat with Mario. And part of it could be, but...
I mean, obviously, we've got very, very little to go on with four static screens and a logo. But I really hope, if they're emphasizing the fact that it might feature the return of the Tanuki suit or whatever, you know, with the raccoon tail using it to fly,
I really do hope it signals the fact that they wish to emphasize it, because power-ups themselves will be more important and perhaps persistent in a way they've not been in EOD Tokyo's Galaxy games or any of the 3D right. Marios. They've always been temporary.
Well, Mario 64 had more emphasis on it, I think.
They all went away after 66.
They were temporary, yeah. But they seemed to be more...
And I mean, some of them were almost exclusively built around how fleeting they were, like the metal cap and the ghost cap. You was just like, well, you've got so long to, like, get to this point while using this power, and then, you know, if you didn't get there in time, you have to still go back and get the cap again. Like, that was the whole thing of them.
Mm-hmm. I greatly missed the flying of the N64 game.
Oh, I love that. I love the wing cap in 64.
I think there's a good chance we'll get stuff like that in this game, thanks to this.
I think the challenge is just how to build it into gameplay that feels really meaningful and structured, because I think the most fun with that is always screwing around with it, which was a huge, huge amount of fun on N64, because it was just experimenting in 3D space. You hadn't done it with the analog stick and the polygonal world, you know, it was all so fresh. But if you were to just to do that now, it would not be so compelling. So how you build it into the kind of really tight game design that we're used to from EOD Tokyo will be very interesting.
Well, I think also if you go back to the Galaxy games, there really isn't that kind of, well, I mean, there's that stupid star you get when you drop off the platform, but I mean, there's that exploring in 3D space is something that really, I mean, they did some in Sunshine, but even there it was starting to go away.
No, they tightened the focus with Galaxy. They made it more like the 2D games.
Right. There is flying in Galaxy. I mean, there's the red cap that you can get.
Yeah, it's kind of like an Easter egg.
Very limited area.
But I mean, just in 3D games, kind of using those as the benchmarks, not necessarily those games in particular. The idea of exploring in 3D space has greatly dropped off since the N64 era.
Well, because I think because, you know, it was more of a novelty then, so people felt like, you know, that was more acceptable to the player, whereas now there's always going to be the question of, is this too pedestrian? Is this too aimless? We need to give the player more structure and gratification.
I think you can get back to that aimlessness, which in a way was kind of nice, because the 3D aspects of the hardware.
I think the fact that, you know, as we've seen, because we've got these N64 reprises coming to 3DS, the stereoscopic 3D element might rekindle the willingness to trade off novelty in that sense. So it's not... Yeah, I mean, I could see them go more in that direction.
Well, of course, Iwata didn't just make a bunch of announcements. He didn't just drop bombs. He also had some philosophical content. I mean, it is supposed to be a sort of inspirational lecture to the game developer audience at GDC. So he talked about Nintendo's philosophy. He quoted a guy at TimeGate Studios, which is a developer I'm not familiar with at all, but he had a couple of really interesting quotes from him, and one of them that I really liked was basically, come up with a great game idea and then figure out how to make it a good business proposition rather than the other way around. And I would love if some people in the audience took that to heart, because I think that is a serious issue in the industry right now.
They just to be clear, they made the Fear games.
Oh, okay. Not anymore, though.
Not Fathria.
Well, yeah, Fathria is by a different studio, and I think even the second game was a different studio.
That they made Section 8, too.
Oh, okay.
Yikes. So, and Mr. Iwata talked about... He sort of, in veiled terms, discussed the issues with iPod games, iPad and iPhone games, especially the fact that they're extremely cheap and often aren't very good. And he's been talking about that in, you know, online lately, but this was interesting for him to bring that message to America and speak to it to a crowd, which I think he actually said, you know, probably half of you, probably the majority of you, have worked on these phone games or are working on them. So he's really speaking to the crowd at this thing, and it was kind of sermonizing a little bit, like, hey, you're going to destroy the game industry if you're not careful about this. So,
yeah, I mean, obviously it wasn't quite that dire in terms of the phraseology, but coming from someone as sort of mildly spoken as Iwata, when he says, you know, I've been talking about all this stuff like the old Halcyon days of the early game development and all the exciting things that we're doing now. But then he says, but it's not all good. You know, I have concerns about it. And it does sound, you know, quite threatening when he puts it like that. So.
Yeah.
To include a bit of Ganginus's letter that we sort of left out, because I think it applies here. I guess he had never heard Iwata speak before and was sort of taken aback by how well he speaks and gets his points across. And I think Iwata did a good job here using a rhetorical device of kind of comparing his own evolution with that of the industry in which he grew up in, essentially. Because he talks about how he was really, really primitive in this stuff, and then he had sort of this kind of brash attitude right about the time the industry went belly up the first time. Mm-hmm. And then he sort of refined himself as a developer, but he sort of talks about how we have that risk with this mobile, of this sort of obsession with these quick games that don't really have the level of refinement.
Well, I mean, he was basically saying that, you know, that there's two competing models of gaming content at the minute. You've got, you know, the ones on dedicated gaming platforms that at their heart are somewhat based around, you know, a sort of premium quality of game that people will be willing to pay,
right,
you know, a good chunk of money for, and, you know, at least theoretically delivers an experience commensurate with that, versus the quantity driven,
mm-hmm,
where the content is almost incidental.
Yeah.
When we're talking about social network games and then the vast swaths of stuff on the App Store and the Android and all that, where, you know, most of the stuff downloaded is completely free. It's without charge at all. And then, you know, what's left over after that is often a couple bucks or less.
And gets ported to DSiWare about 6 months later.
Yeah, yeah, which is a problem for Nintendo for sure, because I'm sure those games aren't really selling very much when they do get ported. And they cost,
well, look,
more
I
on
hope
Nintendo's
they just
platforms.
Keep getting ported, because that means every Monday I get to make fun of them.
Yeah, and well, it keeps the train a rolling, choo choo. So one of the things, though, is that when I watched that part of the video and Iwata's talking about this and he's talking about the dangers of it, I felt like his message was falling flat to a lot of the developers in the audience, because the thing is, for Nintendo, the prospect of selling games for 99¢ is completely untenable. There's no way Nintendo's a giant corporation. They have thousands of employees. They sell millions of these products, and they depend on primarily licensing revenues. I mean, that's where most of Nintendo's money comes from, is licensing revenues on third-party games, as well as the pure profits on their first-party games, because they don't have to pay anyone else for licensing on those titles. So Nintendo is not used to paying licensing to anyone on anything, because they make their own hardware.
They've never paid licensing.
No, yeah. And they collect licenses from other people. So this is big business for them. For a lot of the people in the audience and a lot of the companies that go to GDC, we have in the US as well as in Japan and around the world, there are game studios made up of five people like Gaijin Games, and they make games in a month for very little money, and they sell them for 99¢, but they sell a million copies of them. They just made $1 million. Now, $1 million to Satoru Iwata is chump change.
Mm-hmm.
He can't pay his employees for two weeks.
It's my vacation
that.
In Hawaii money.
Yeah, but for these small companies, it's very different. And the thing about the whole iPhone store and Android 2 is that it is allowing these smaller developers to make a lot of money. If they come up with a great idea that clicks with people for whatever reason, and if they market it very cleverly, and there's a lot of that stuff that goes on in the store, but if they play their cards right, they can make tons and tons and tons of money. So the idea that this is benefiting no one to create a market where all the games are $1 and $2 or they won't sell, it's benefiting a lot of people a lot.
But just not Nintendo necessarily.
And the funny thing is, it's not really benefiting Apple very much, except that they sell more hardware because people want to play these games.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure Nintendo can relate to. So the thing is, yeah, that's a really bad business model for Nintendo, and it's hard for them to compete against it. But for the consumer, it's not that bad, and for the developers, it's great. So
yeah.
I felt that message kind of fell flat, really.
It's kind of hypocritical, I think. Because effectively what Nintendo did is they kind of undercut the prices on everybody with stuff like the Wii hardware, and they made the games a little bit simpler, and a lot of people bitched about it, like, oh, they're making these simple games that anybody
and
can
Wii
play.
Wii games were cheaper than the competitors.
Exactly.
Well, and one could raise the specter of quality control.
Absolutely.
In that obviously there's a lot more requirements that are asked of people, especially from Microsoft.
Yep.
Whereas on Nintendo systems, there's not a great deal of it that's very apparent. So, yes, you could argue that they're a bit closer to that kind of environment than they might like to admit. But
I suppose the real fear that Iwata must have, I can only sort of infer from his comments, is of a race to the bottom, ultimately.
Yeah.
That we get to a point where the pervasiveness of the social network games, you know, just incidental kind of games that you have on a device that you carry around with you all the time because it's your phone, that becomes what gaming is to such a section of the population that they become completely unreachable if you ask them to pay more than a couple bucks for something.
Yep.
Yeah, well, the thing is, what Nintendo puts out there, I mean, Wii and DS and 3DS and all the games for them are basically premium products. I mean, video games are expensive. And what Apple has done, and look, I'm not an Apple lover by any means, but what they've done is made this stuff a lot more accessible to a broader audience. I mean, basically, Nintendo went all Blue Ocean with Wii and DS, and then Apple trumped them big time. They went way more Blue Ocean. They've got people paying 99 cents for video games who would never, ever buy a Wii, who would never buy a DS, or buy any of the games on them. And part of the reason is that it's a lot more affordable.
Well, what it reminds me of is sort of the history, actually, of, you know, what happened with the British gaming scene back in the early 80s when, you know, you had a whole gaming phenomenon arise from, you know, home personal computers that weren't really intended for that. And that's kind of what's, you know, I don't think Apple really, you know, when they were establishing these things, foresaw, you know, how important that the App Store would be in the gaming space. But it's just kind of grown up kind of organically. But the question is whether there'll be a sort of similar fate to it at the end, that it becomes oversaturated. There is a race to the bottom. And even in that area, it kind of cannibalizes itself. But I'm not convinced that that's as inexorable as Iwata seems to think, or necessarily that what will happen there will spill over into the premium end of the market.
I would point out that the games themselves are more affordable, but the cost of having an iPhone dwarfs even the launch price of having a Wii.
Yeah, but you can buy an iPod Touch that plays all the same games for less than the cost of a DS.
And also, the thing is with that is that most people would buy a cell phone and have a cell phone bill anyways.
Yeah, but it's not the same, though. I mean, I could have a cell phone bill for $20.
True, and you could buy a cheap cell phone, but you're still going to have a monthly bill.
It still has to be factored into the cost if that's the reason you've bought the hardware.
Yeah,
it does, but the games themselves... But here's the thing, James. A lot of people are buying iPhones not because they play games. That's what I'm saying. I mean, it really is it's creating new gamers, which Iwata loves to talk about, and he always has tons of PowerPoint slides about, look how many new gamers Nintendo's created.
Yep.
But he doesn't include iPhone on that chart, does he?
Well, and we could only assume that from his rhetoric that basically what he's saying is that it's not creating new gamers in the sense that, you know, what Nintendo says they're doing, whether they're actually doing it is a little more up for grabs, but you know, they get people with stuff like Nintendogs, and then they graduate them upstream, and then they become repeat purchasers of premium product games, you know, very traditional games.
Yeah, I'd like to see the data.
Yeah, well, as I said, how much that's really working, but what, so we can only assume what he believes about the iPhone kind of market is that it creates people who have a perception of games that it's not a premium product. It's like, you know, now, this is gaming to me. This is what it is. It's something that I can play for free. It's something I can play without really thinking about it. You know, it's just tied to the fact that, you know, it's on Facebook or it's on my phone or whatever. And I would never go out of my way to pay for or play premium products in this sort of range. You know, this is my level. And then it somehow seals them off from being graduated upstream by Nintendo.
There's no way it seals them off. It opens them up to the idea that they could pay money for video games, because a lot of the people who are buying this stuff would never think that before. And I think rather than bitch about it, I think Nintendo should start figuring out how they can convert some of those users to their systems, to premium users who are willing to spend more money on it. Because at the end of the day, if the iPhone game market does crash, Nintendo's still going to be around, because there will always be people who want these premium experiences. There are people like us who want the 40-hour RPGs and are willing to spend $50 on them.
Yep.
So I don't really see what Nintendo has to worry about. I don't think there are that many people who play all kinds of stuff on the DS and think, you know, oh, I'm just going to trade this in and get an iPhone instead because I want to play Angry Birds. The only people who are going to think that way are people who are playing shitty licensed kids crap on the DS.
Yeah,
in the
but
first
I
place.
Think it, I think what you would have to look at this though is not so much, you know, specific individuals changing their mind, but it's the stock flow situation. It's the people that don't get into 3DS now, let's say, you know, because they just they find a level that they're happy with and they stick with it, and so you get fewer people going into that, you know, Nintendo fan bracket, and of course there's always going to be a loss of fan people, you know, they get older, they get less free time, they just fall out of the habit, and so you always need to have new people coming in. Yeah. To even maintain the fan base, let alone grow it, and you know, obviously he believes that this is a threat to doing that, but you know, as you said, I don't think it's so clear cut whether that's actually true. And more to the point, you could look at it as a challenge, as an opportunity, rather than you know, a harbinger of doom or anything else.
Right. Well, what it is a threat to is Nintendo selling crap like Brain Age for $20, yeah. Personal Trainer Walking for $20, when you know a kid can program that same shit and sell it for 99¢ on the iOS store, and they have. And people, yeah. I mean, when people see that comparison, they're like, oh, wow, this non-game shit that Nintendo's been selling me on DS really isn't worth it. And a lot of it is not worth it. I mean, I reviewed Personal Training Math, and let me tell you, that's not worth $2, much less $20, which is what it sold for. So, yeah, it's a threat to Nintendo in that it pulls up the veil on some of the stuff they're selling. But New Super Mario Bros. DS, you're not going to find anything remotely like that on the iPhone store. So if Nintendo would just make the games that people want them to make and would make the stuff that Nintendo, that only Nintendo can make, then this other market's not a threat to them.
Yeah, well, I mean, Sony is going to allow effectively cell phone games on the new PSP.
The Android stuff's going to be on NGP, yeah.
Yeah, which is effectively them basically raising the white flag saying, yeah, there is no way. I mean, basically, we can't beat them, so join them.
Well, the minis thing, I mean, I don't know much about it, but that does not seem like it's been a successful initiative for them.
No.
No, not really. You know, and the other thing about, I mean, look at DSiWare, which was, I think, Nintendo's attempt to cash in somewhat on that market.
It was trying to create a sort of intermediate position.
Yeah, but...
Well, it's not all the way to the kind of Wild West, like, a lot of it's free, a lot of it's worth nothing, intellectual property rights aren't particularly well-respected madness of the App Store, but obviously trying to create little games for little prices.
Well, and it hasn't worked because the floor on DSiWare pricing is $2, which almost nothing is assigned to, and from there it goes up to $5 and then up to $8. And by the way, Nintendo chooses the prices for everyone's games.
Yes.
So they're not going to let that market become flooded. And as a consequence, you know, I mean, on the iPhone store, you choose, you put out a game, you choose how much it costs. And you can change that day to day. You can have sales. You can compete with what the perceived value of similar games is on the marketplace. And a lot of companies have found a lot of success doing that. You can't do that on DSiWare. It's up to Nintendo, and they're probably going to price it at $5 or more, even if you think it should be sold for $1.
And I do think this goes back in Nintendo's history, this philosophy, because you know they were the company that rekindled the gaming industry after the big disaster of the, you know, the crash of the early mid-80s. And the way they did it was by restricting quantity. You know, they had all those rules on the NES about you could only publish so many games in a given year. Well, it's they probably still hold that to their, you know, hearts, that that kind of really unbridled marketplace has a dark side, and that's what they see in the App Store.
I get that, but it's such a completely different marketplace now. We're not talking about Atari 2600 cartridges filling up grocery yeah. store shelves and having to be cleared out. We're talking
about the concept of inventory, like right. it just ceased to exist.
Yeah, so I don't think the same lessons apply here. It's a very, very different situation. And the consumer is a lot smarter about what's going on because they have user ratings, they have daily updated stores with lists of the most popular things. Just your access to information about what games are out there and what games might be good is so completely different. Mm-hmm. than it was back in 1984. And the other thing about Nintendo is a lot of what, I mean, if you read the stories about Nintendo and the resurgence of the gaming market back in the late 80s, yeah, Nintendo did certain things that were arguably illegal at the time about trying to control how many games people could make and, you know, how many units the stores had to buy and things like that. But also, Nintendo just happened to be the only company that was actually willing to try to put out a system in that time frame.
Yeah.
In America, especially.
The opportunity was there, you know, clearly.
There was a vacuum and they filled it. They didn't necessarily do it a whole lot different than other companies before. They did in certain ways, but it wasn't like a completely different business model. So actually, on a similar topic, we got a letter from Ken who wrote, if Apple wants to pretend iTunes and iPhone / iPod / iPad are a gaming platform, why is it that the people making these $1 games don't have to pay the ESRB for a rating like on Xbox Live, PSN, WiiWare, and DSiWare? Excellent question.
Because Apple's not part of the ESA.
Exactly.
It's a voluntary organization. It does not have, you know, the same kind of requirements as it would, say, for instance, if it was a statutory ratings system.
Yeah.
And obviously, I mean, the ecosystem really wouldn't work in the same way if they did have to, because in some cases, those costs, which, you know, might be trivial with like a AAA game, are suddenly in percentage terms quite vast compared to what it takes to make some of these little apps.
Right. Yeah, I think the interesting situation here is that, I mean, and Apple is running their app store like the PC, where you also don't have to get ESRB rating for PC games because there's no platform holder.
Right. I mean, that's the only reason you have to get them at all. I mean, you could in theory put out games on Nintendo consoles without them, just Nintendo will never let you.
Yeah, they'd be unlicensed and
right. I mean, Nintendo doesn't have to require a rating to maintain their ESA compliance, but they do.
Yeah, I think the interesting possibility here is that maybe for these download platforms like Xbox Live, PSN, WiiWare, and DSiWare, the platform holders could probably opt out of ESRB ratings for those parts of their business. So you'd still have E for Everyone on your boxed retail copy, but if you download some...
And they can do that. Nintendo chooses not to.
Right. Well, all three of them choose not to, but I think that day may come when they decide that in order to compete with PC games, you know, with Steam, and also especially with Apple's platforms, then they may need to lift that restriction and just say, hey, you want to make a WiiWare game? You don't have to pay for the ESRB rating. Just send it to us and we'll check over it. And you got to think with Nintendo, they're probably going to test the shit out of that game anyway. So if it's sexy rape time or whatever, they're not going to let it on their platform anyway. Yeah. They don't need the ESRB to filter that out for them.
They let Enjoy Your Massage on the platform. And that's pretty much...
That's true.
Come on. That's as clean as can be.
By the way, Enjoy Your Massage...
It's pure as driven snow.
Enjoy Your Massage podcast, PAX East.
Yeah. More on that later. Yeah, I think there may come a day when ESRB ratings do disappear for these digital platforms, because it does seem like an unnecessary hindrance on the business model.
I did want to touch back on, but you know, what Gonzalez's previous question, where he said about what do you think about Nintendo's future with Iwata? You know, I mean, the important thing to remember about Iwata is that he is a developer. You know, he was a developer, and he is also the head of the company, which is not something that other Japanese companies do. For instance, that was sort of involved in who's the Capcom chap? Inafune.
Yeah.
Inafune's departure from Capcom was some of his frustration was basically that, you know, he felt in that corporate structure, a game developer, he had a glass ceiling that
right.
he could not ascend to the kind of position that Iwata has. So I do feel better about Nintendo's future, the fact that they have someone like that there.
And he's still reasonably young, too. I mean, he's not an old guy.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, Yamauchi ran that company till he was in his mid-80s.
Yes.
Yeah.
For me, what's interesting is that when he came out of HAL into Nintendo, shot up the corporate ladder really fast. And I think it's more of a commentary that on him, as both in his terms of his insights in the industry, his relative intelligence, and his leadership skills, that he was identified by Mr. Yamauchi. That he should be the successor.
Yeah, it was a very surprising pick and has turned out to be really brilliant.
Yeah, I still feel pretty good with him at the helm, but I do think, you know, they need to be willing to adapt to changes. You know, I mean, obviously Nintendo has kind of dictated to some extent the changes in the industry over the past so many years. You know, but as we've seen now with Kinect to Move, people are sort of, you know, following along to their tune. But there are other forces that are going to change the games industry other than just themselves, and they need to be ready to adapt when that happens.
Right. I think Nintendo, in some capacities, would do well to learn from what other people are doing.
Yeah.
And they've never really done that in the past. But you look, they're seriously playing catch up with things like online connectivity and digital download sales and marketing now. You know, and Iwata has...
Even those press releases don't count?
Well, I do think Iwata has lately been acknowledging their problems.
He did in the keynote itself. I mean,
they're trying to rectify some of these things.
I think especially, you know, vis-a-vis Yamauchi, Iwata demonstrates a sort of comforting level of humility. That perhaps in the future they will adapt to things rather than just try and hit them over the head.
I think right now the real test is I'm waiting to see what direction they take with the next console. That will tell me a lot about how much they've actually learned from the past few years, from what their competitors have done successfully.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean, the thing is, Wii is the top console. So Nintendo is at a high risk, I think, of being arrogant and saying, we're just going to do what we did again. And that would be a huge mistake. So the 3DS, I think, it looks like a step in the right direction, but at the same time, there's certain things about it that I'm not so sure about.
It's price tag for starters. I mean,
it's kind of a weird place because they have to be responsive to what other people have done and what the industry needs, but they kind of have to be anticipatory too.
Oh, they definitely have to be innovative.
It's a weird place to be for them because as it stands, they're never going to be able to compete technologically. They just don't have the horses. So that they kind of have to do things their own way anyway, and sometimes doing things the Nintendo way is being completely batshit crazy. They don't have a choice but to reach. And just pray to God we don't wind up with something like the Virtual Boy.
All right. On that note, let's move on to some more letters here. James, can you read the next one, please?
Zoe writes, is the F-Zero series worth playing compared to games like Gran Turismo? And is there maybe a chance of it making a comeback on Wii or, better yet, 3DS?
John, what do you think about this comparison?
It's apples to oranges. I mean, the two games are so different.
It's apples to oranges where one apple doesn't take damage and the other blows up if you look at it wrong.
If you've played, I mean, you're talking about Gran Turismo, so maybe you've played Wipeout, which is another Sony racing franchise. That's much closer to F-Zero.
Yeah, I mean, F-Zero is arcadey racing, extremely fast, not realistic in the slightest.
But I guess the distinction would be from certain other arcade games, like, you know, Mario Kart. It's not completely divorced from racing fundamentals.
Yeah.
You know, it is still very much a racing game, but it's just kind of streamlined and, you know, as John says, not realistic.
Well, because they're hovercraft. I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's not much combat in F-Zero. It's about racing. It's about going really fast. It's about passing the other cars. It's not about shooting missiles at them to knock them off the road.
You know, and Gran Turismo, Forza, those games, they are driving simulators. They try to, you know, recreate the actual feeling of driving the cars that they have in there.
Yeah, they're more driving simulators than racing games.
Especially Gran Turismo.
you race, yep. But ultimately your objective is to hit the right number of revs going into turn 7 of the Nürburgring.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're much more technical.
I mean, for me, F-Zero pretty much hits the sweet spot. It's it is about racing. If you have, you know, a sound racing line, if you use your boosts in smart places, you know, for instance.
A lot of it's avoiding your opponents, actually.
Yeah, but at the same time, it is... I feel a lot more accessible, even though the series is quite famous for its difficulty. We don't have to play it on the higher difficulties, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Or just not play the story modes in GX.
Yeah, most of them don't have story modes. So
just
it's not
don't
really
do
that
it.
pertinent. So, I mean, it's the kind of thing that I could see making a comeback, especially on 3DS.
Yeah, I would love it on 3DS. Oh, it'd be awesome.
Motion sickness everywhere.
Pilot Wings, as we know, is back, and that's been away for a long time, a lot longer than F-Zero, actually. F-Zero and Pilot Wings both started as early Super Nintendo games because of, you know, the novelty of what was then 3D, which was Mode 7, you know, the sprite scaling sort of trick. The fact that we've got stereoscopic 3D now, I think it lends itself to the sensation of speed that you could have with an F-Zero game on that, embellished by the depth. It seems like, yeah, if it's ever going to come back, now or soon is the time. If it doesn't, right. If we don't hear anything relatively soon, I'm kind of worried that F-Zero is buried.
Yeah, well, it's not in full-on hibernation yet, but it's kind of on the cusp of that.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's to the point where they don't quite have to reboot it like they are Kid Icarus, but if they wait much longer, they will.
I mean, there's not so much to do on the reboot unless you're going to make a Captain Falcon fighting game. I mean, it's not quite Kid Icarus, where it was basically a reappropriation of the engine of another game, and they had to kind of come up with modern gameplay mechanics that made Sin and Punishment 3. It's a racing game.
I would absolutely say that the games are worth playing if you have. I think F-Zero X, we've discussed before, is probably the best entry point because it's the most forgiving and it's the most crazy.
And it's on Virtual Console. It's very easy to get.
It's on Virtual Console. It's very accessible. As long as you can accept the fact that it is extremely primitive aesthetically, you should be able to have fun with that.
It's kind of ugly, I guess. Even at the time, I actually remember reading the EGM review of F-Zero X back in, like, 1997, and it said, the graphics really aren't, like, the car models are really simple, and the graphics kind of aren't that good, but they let the game run at 60 frames per second.
Exactly.
So it's super smooth.
I think it's a wonderful decision that they made. They had in an era when, online media was nascent, so you didn't really get videos of games. You didn't see what was impressive about it, which was the speed, which even then, that would be lessened, because you don't get the full effect of the 60 frames per second on a streaming video. But you couldn't get that at all. You saw it in screenshots. It looked like shit. But they were willing to do that in an era when screenshots mattered so much, because that's what made the game play
better.
Same
thing sort of happened with GX. I mean,
GX is beautiful.
GX looks fantastic. It's like the best looking game on the system.
It didn't look so amazing until you saw it in motion, though.
Oh, I agree. I mean, it's very much more apparent when you see it in motion.
Even the colors were picked, so when in motion, you realized, oh, wow.
It's utterly fabulous in motion, but it was more than passable in static shots.
All right, Greg, can you please read the next letter?
Harold writes, do you guys think that the 3DS will have a big variety of remade games? Do you think Nintendo should have re-released a different Zelda title, like maybe Majora's Mask or Wind Waker instead of Ocarina of Time?
Hmm.
I would like them to re-release Majora's Mask.
I would love Majora's Mask.
I think it's great for a portable game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, yesterday during the GDC, so Wednesday, they put out some more Ocarina of Time screenshots, which really do look considerably better than what we've had so far.
I agree. These are the most impressive screenshots that I've seen.
So it does seem to me that they care more than we probably thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really weird halfway house, because it's not, it's certainly not up to the levels that the system is capable of, especially the polygon count in some of the models. If you've seen a screenshot of the Great Fairy, that still looks as disturbingly angular as ever. So they're not really, they're not doing a complete overhaul, but at the same time, it's certainly not a port.
Right.
They are rebuilding the game. The textures have definitely been revisited. Certainly Link's model looks very different. They've gone to some effort in certain areas.
It does look better than we had originally feared.
Well, I will say that all the newest media for that remake makes me feel a lot better that it exists, because when I first saw the video of it at E3 last year,
that was not impressive.
It looked like a Virtual Console game. I mean, it's just
3D classics.
Well, it was.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It was.
I was like, you're going to sell this for $40? Really?
It looked like the original version of the game. I mean, there was nothing about it that looked special.
And just didn't really pop out in 3D very much. I was down on that game from the first time I saw it, but I think it's starting to look better and better.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
The image of Adult Link fighting the Ganondorf paintings, it's still kind of flat textures and stuff, but it's better than it was. There's some level of graphical effect going on now.
So, I mean, clearly, I think we should still expect, even though it's not trivial, I think we should still expect quite a lot of remakes, beyond Star Fox and all that. Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing that probably will fade away as the system gets its legs under it. It's the kind of thing that companies do early on in a system's life.
Right.
GBA, that was true.
Yep.
DS, GBA, that went on forever.
GBA was pretty ridiculous, actually. But in this case, I mean, look, as we've said, it's kind of, with 3D in general, it's something that people are eager or certainly amenable to green lighting is something that we've already had, but now it's in 3D. So just that kind of pervasive corporate thinking is probably going to give us a lot of this kind of stuff.
It's very low risk.
Yeah.
I mean, Ocarina of Time 3D is going to sell a bunch of copies. Just
but, that's the thing. That's why it's Ocarina. I mean, to go to the heart of the question.
That's why it's not Majora's Mask and not Wind Waker.
In terms of sales, I'm not sure about it versus Link to the Past, but after that, it is undoubtedly the biggest selling Zelda game.
Now, I would basically be outside NOA headquarters just screaming, take my money, if they went and tried to port Wind Waker over. Because
see, Wind Waker, in many ways, I think if Wind Waker had been the hit that Ocarina of Time was, and obviously that had a lot to do with just the GameCube, it was not as successful as the N64, especially in America. But I think that would have been the natural choice from the point of view that, it is more impressive.
It looks more like a 3DS game.
Yeah, but it wasn't such a landmark game, though.
I know it wasn't, but that's what I mean.
It is gorgeous. I mean, it's still gorgeous.
If it had been the hit that Ocarina had been. If it had been as important, as successful, then you could have that and say, look, this is what we could do with the system. Which is still regarded as one of the most beautiful games ever made, recreated perfectly in your hands.
In 3D. And it would uphold the aesthetic chain of the DS Zelda games.
Yeah, they've already gone to, that's what Link is, who Link is to portable players.
I think Wind Waker actually could be remade on down the line.
I would be thrilled if they re-release Wind Waker, because
I think there's sufficient demand for that. And
I mean, it's either second or third favorite Zelda game. I mean, I really love that.
Can we get the missing dungeon back?
That would be nice.
Lower the cost of the Triforce maps a little bit.
Yeah, we'll just get rid of them altogether.
I don't mind having to pay for them. I did mind having to pay that much. Because there's a certain extent of having to go back to Tingle's Island and speaking to his, quote, brothers, where things became creepier and creepier every time you went.
Preposterously onerous process.
So Majora's Mask, I think it's unlikely that's going to get a remake. I would be very happy about that.
I would be happy because I said Wind Waker was 3, Majora's Mask is 2.
Yeah, I prefer Majora's Mask over Ocarina of Time.
Well, to replay especially because...
And 1 is already on 3DS.
Not only did you probably replay Ocarina quite a bit back in the day, and then you had the pre-order with Wind Waker disc version and the virtual console, etc. But one could argue the experience of playing the subsequent Zelda games is a bit like replaying Ocarina of Time, whereas Majora's Mask has no such counterparts.
Right.
When you go back to Majora's Mask, it's still, even though you replay a game you've already played, a relatively unique experience.
I mean, Twilight Princess, because you can say, I played Ocarina of Time when it came out on Wii.
It's not, I mean, I reject that level of how similar they are.
They are two of the most similar games in the franchise.
That's taking it a bit far, but there's no doubt, compared to Majora's Mask, they are two peas in a pod.
Yeah, right. I mean, compared to any of the 3D games, those two are 1A and 1B in terms of, like, what they are.
But even Wind Waker, for all its beauty and the storytelling stronger and all that, for me, it still is very similar from the point of view that it's get a bunch of stuff, get the Master Sword, get some more stuff, go beat Ganon. It's still... That macro structure is the same as Twilight Princess and Ocarina, which is what makes Majora's Mask special, because it isn't like that.
Yeah, the thing about Majora's Mask is that it wouldn't make any sense for them to make that the first Zelda remake on 3DS. I mean, they're not going to do that before they redo Ocarina. It could follow Ocarina, but I kind of doubt it just because... It's not that beloved.
But what about the 3D classics? I mean, doesn't that seem like the venue for that?
I think 3D classics is going to be more like very simple 8-bit games that are very easy to...
just split the layers.
Exactly. They can separate the bitmap layers.
Well, there's no doubt that that is going to be a pretty significant part of the 3DS classics.
I don't know
library.
How easy it would be to just simply add 3D effect to a game that's made out of polygons, because the depth of field and the camera work there is very different.
I imagine it would be more complex, but I mean, obviously, as we say, it wouldn't be on the level of these retail remakes. It wouldn't be on that level of enhancements. But I think there needs to be a place on the eShop for this kind of middle product, something that's not as cheaply priced as a virtual console game or, you know, the existing kind of suite of DSiWare. But on the other hand, there isn't a full retail product, you know, with a full retail price, which, as we know, with 3DS, they are, you know, moving the bar on that as well to $40.
And by the way, did you guys notice when Iwata was talking about eShop at GDC, he didn't mention 3DSware.
No.
Which, if you're going to mention it, GDC is a pretty damn good place to mention it, where you've got all those companies there who could be making those games.
They had a whole segment about the eShop, and that did not come up.
There was no you kept waiting for the little line of like, and of course, you know, original games that you will use the 3D.
Right. The eShop, no original games allowed.
Well, and I wonder if, you know, I mean, like with WiiWare, that didn't launch until over a year, almost a year and a half after Wii was out.
2008, yeah.
Yeah, it was early 2008. So, it was May 2008. And so I wonder if maybe they're planning to hold off on 3DSware because they've got all this other stuff competing with it in the eShop, and they want to give people more time to actually build
those
games.
Well, given how late all of this is falling into place, that has to be a possibility.
It could be that 3DSware development is lagging so far behind that.
But again, it's not just announcing it to us, it's announcing it to developers, and mm-hmm. GDC is the place you would want to do that.
Yep.
So that concerns me. It makes me wonder if 3DSware isn't coming out until next year's GDC.
It could just be they don't know yet. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff they don't
that
know.
That concerns
right now.
Me too, James.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be really doing this on the fly.
I thought 3DSware would actually be the centerpiece of Iwata's talk because it's GDC.
Well, I mean, it was almost begging for it from the point of view that we talked about. He offered this dichotomy between Nintendo, and he lumped Microsoft and Sony in with Nintendo as one approach, and then what's going on at Apple and whatnot and as another. It might have been more meaningful to illustrate that dichotomy, to actually offer an alternative way of doing things digitally.
Right.
If they had one, that would be a good idea.
All right, the next letter is from Jovial Jeffer, who writes, "What did you think of Chrono Cross? I know it wasn't on a Nintendo system, but it was the sequel to Chrono Trigger on the Super Nintendo."
So who here played it?
I have not.
I have not played it.
I beat it.
I heard was disappointment out of that game.
I wasn't disappointed. I beat it, and then I got the real ending for the stupid-ass boss battle. You had to hit him in the right order of magic. Fuck that thing.
That game had an insane magic system.
It's really busy.
Yeah, what's just funny about Chrono Cross is that when I kind of first heard about it, having played Chrono Trigger, and you know, I wasn't following it that closely because, of course, it wasn't for a system that I owned at the time or I was going to own, but I had some interest. When they described Cross, you know, just the word Cross, and you know, the whole idea of, you know, maybe parallel worlds and stuff, what I kind of imagined was something like what Radiant Historia is.
Right.
Which is, you know, like two timelines in parallel, crossing between the two of them, and yeah, still time traveling, but also traveling between timelines as well as back and forth in one.
There's no actual time travel in Chrono Cross.
A Cross and Trigger hybrid is almost Radiant Historia. I mean,
yeah, see but that's what I was imagining, and I was kind of disappointed when I heard that is not really at all what it is.
I love Chrono Cross, actually. I mean, it's completely insane, and there's 100,000 characters to keep track of.
Which is the worst thing about the game, actually.
And there's a million things going on. The story is completely incomprehensible.
It makes no sense. Seriously, that story makes
well, no
sense.
Well, no, what's
sense.
Funny is it almost makes sense, and then the Chrono Trigger characters show up, and you're like, fuck, I don't know what just happened. Like, you'll throw the controller in the air because your hands will invariably fling to the skies as you no longer have any ability to control
your
motor
functions.
Look,
it's a parallel. It's a world that never should have been. Just accept it. You know, there's all these myriad different worlds, and that one is wrong.
That's actually true. That's the plot of the game, effectively.
See, I think the reason I don't remember much about how the story in Chrono Cross ends is that I didn't understand it leading up to that point, and so when it got really crazy at the end, I just stopped paying attention to it.
I read a synopsis of it after I played. I'm like, I still don't understand what happened.
The cheat sheet.
It actually seems likely that Chrono Cross will come to PSN soon.
Well, it is confirmed to be on its way for Japan, which in the past meant jack shit in terms of its chances for coming to America, but with this push that we're seeing now with Xenogears and Vagrant Story, then perhaps it might well be on its way eventually, which I would like to try it
it's worth trying for sure.
The soundtrack is lauded as being fantastic.
Is certainly one of my favorite game soundtracks. I like the soundtrack much more than I like the game.
I'm not joking or trying to be overly congratulatory. That is probably the best opening theme to a game ever.
It's got, what I've heard of, it's got a very nice Celtic vibe to it.
Yeah,
it's
does.
Quite distinct from Chrono Trigger. Oh, and obviously the instrumentation was very different because it was a CD game. The biggest worry that I have about playing it in its original state, you know, if we're talking about it on PSN rather than some sort of re-release or remake, would be that apparently like it had the one of the things that was very common in those 32-bit RPGs, which is like a stupid long opening to battle scenes, so that the battles kind of took a while to get going. Is that accurate, would you say?
I recall the battles being very fast, actually.
Because that is what I love about Chrono Trigger, is that the battles are very fast, and it kind of is very seamless. You know, one minute you're walking around the dungeon or wherever it is you are, and you go towards an enemy, and the battle just begins. You know, there's no, like, discontinuity between walking around an overworld and then...
The thing is, Chrono Cross is based on pre-rendered backgrounds.
Right.
So the battles don't take place... They do switch to a separate view.
Right.
And that takes a certain amount of time, but it's probably less now through emulation.
Oh, definitely.
And I don't recall it being that bad in the first place. And once you're actually in the battles, they are very fast-paced.
They're a hell of a lot more complicated than the Chrono Trigger battles, though. They are...
That's very simple, Chrono Trigger, which, again, I kind of like that.
They are incredibly convoluted. I mean, the magic system, like Johnny alluded to, is convoluted as hell.
One thing I'll say about Chrono Cross, I do like the game. I own it somewhere, and I beat it. And I would say it's worth playing, but I think calling it a sequel to Chrono Trigger is a bit overblown. It has connections to Chrono Trigger.
They
it's
show
made
up.
By some of the same people, but a lot of different people as well. And it was a completely different hardware generation. It really feels different in a lot of ways. So it's not like if you love Chrono Trigger, you absolutely have to play Chrono Cross, or it's not like you have to have played Chrono Trigger to appreciate Chrono Cross. They are quite different games.
Yeah, really. I mean, those characters that overlap for 10 minutes. I mean, they are super minor characters.
The problem with these characters is that, I mean, you can use them in battle, but none of them has more than like 10 lines of dialogue. I mean, they're not developed at all. They make no sense. They have no place in that story.
I would say about six of the party members have some development.
There's over 40 characters in that game, I think.
Yeah, I think there's like
30
like,
or 40 characters.
Yeah, I think there's like 30. So, I mean, all right,
it's
so
insane.
Six or seven of your party members have story.
It makes no sense. I mean, I think the only RPG with so many characters that I thought was done well is like actually FF6, which has 14 characters.
Which is still less than this game by a large margin.
Yeah. But FF6 has 14 playable characters, and two of them are basically bonus characters with very little backstory.
Mm-hmm.
That would be Gogo and Umaro. And still, both of those are considerably better developed than most of the characters in Chrono Cross. So,
yeah,
and then the other 12 characters all have
substantial backstories. Yep.
This is 30 freaking characters. I mean,
but yeah, Chrono Cross is cool. You should play it when you get a chance.
It's an attractive game too, actually.
Well, today's, I don't know by today's standards.
No, but I mean, at the time it was really amazing.
Oh, it's very colorful. I mean, compared to FF7, considering it probably runs on the same engine as FF7 and FF8, it's a lot more cartoony and it's a lot more colorful for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, John has the final letter of today.
All right. Sergeant Foster, a.k.a. Controller Flex, writes, I figured out why so many listeners be all on your jock.
Oh, boy.
And I've slobbed on that knob a couple times as well after hearing your podcast. Of course, Mr. Leahy's editing is the best. Full stop.
You see, notice he used the proper British... full stop as opposed to period. I'm very, very pleased with that attention to detail, Sergeant Foster.
Impressive, impressive. James motherfucking Jones ensures that he
awesome.
Plays all the shitty games so we don't have to. Mr. Lynn Daman, D-A-M-A-N.
He learned that from you as well, Mr. Ronaman.
Daman can explain any box art on the planet, and Dr. Metz, well, is N-E-V-E-R wrong. someone please tell Johnny to stop hitting me. But seriously, everyone at NWR, do what they do out of pure passion. While most other sites and podcasts like yours are filled with paid journalists who can become hyper/hypocritical in the same conversation.
I point out that while the four of us are on this podcast, we have a lot of staff members on the site who are incredibly devoted and amazing.
Yes.
I mean, we have a lot of staff members who, honestly, we have no business having kept this, considering we can't pay them.
Yes. I mean,
we try to tell you about them on Now Playing every week.
We don't deserve them, let's put it that way. But
if you listen to Now Playing and you laugh at us giggling over ourselves and you never actually go check that stuff out, you really should, because there's some excellent content at the website.
Yeah.
Really amazing stuff.
It's actually, I've been really happy, especially the last month or so. Once we got rid of the dead weight, I've been really happy with how the site's going.
Oh, jettisons of weight will never make it to Cybertron.
Are you talking about John? Yeah. Is John the dead weight?
I didn't say anything.
Well, thank you, Sergeant Foster, for your wonderful email. Thank you, John, for reading it so faithfully to the letter.
I do what I can for the community.
For the community? Oh, you're going to take the community manager title from me now, John?
Hey, don't get crazy. Don't get crazy. I'm contributing. I'm contributing, but I'm not moderating.
Contributing.
There's a big difference.
Can we make John senior contributing editor?
Very senior.
Well, how's about senior contributing advising editor?
What are you advising on? How to not do stuff?
John's advice is LOL.
Once a week, 13 replies from John from emails from Tuesday, all of them LOL.
All right. Thank you, everybody who wrote in. We'll have more emails after PAX East. So some of you hopefully will actually be seeing in person and answering your questions live at the convention. But yes, so the programming schedule. Basically, this episode goes out on Sunday, as usual, I hope.
If it's Sunday, it's RFN.
Yep.
And I could say that because Meet the Press has a podcast too, so swivel on that, Gregory.
Call him out, Leahy. And of course, the following Saturday, March 12th, we will be in Boston doing our panel at 10:30 a.m. in the Cat Theater. So we hope you're going to be there. If you're not, we may be live streaming the audio. Ooh. We're not sure if that's going to be possible, but check the website if you're interested in listening to that. We will definitely be recording the panel, and we'll have the audio of that up as soon as possible. I hope Saturday night, but it may be Sunday, which would be on the normal schedule anyway.
If it's Sunday.
Yes. But yes, I will have the panel audio up as soon as possible. We just got to make sure that it sounds good. We may have video of it eventually. It'll probably take a little bit longer to get that up, but we'll hopefully be doing that as well. We are probably going to record other podcasts while we're at PAX East. I'm not promising another drunk cast, but you never know.
I wouldn't make your plans that explicit, because James might confiscate all the alcohol in the state to prevent it from
that's
happening.
You don't understand. I could start dumping it in the ocean, and I would poison all the fish just clearing out Boston.
So we are planning to record a rough draft while we're in Boston, which actually that podcast came out of the Drunk Cast last year. So the Drunk Cast was so successful, it spawned other podcasts.
Yes.
We have had requests for another Magic Cast, so...
from whom?
Oh.
We will see if that happens, and you know, maybe we'll come up with something completely new. I don't know what's going to come out of PAX East other than the panel, but probably something, and we'll get that up when we get it up. So look forward to that. Greg has a weekend off. Greg, what do you think you're going to do?
I don't know yet. It's been since E3, since I had a total week off. I was relieved of editing duties by the live show, but that in itself was quite time consuming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was.
9 months ago, it was my birthday with the week that you were at E3. So I haven't had a week off that wasn't my birthday since the NFL draft. And that was the NFL draft. So I don't know what I'm going to do.
You're just gonna spin in circles for 3 days, aren't you?
I've spent weekends doing that.
I'm finally gonna upgrade the Technodrome so we can get up there.
Awesome. Man, we really wish you were going to be there. So next time.
You'll be fine. You did very well last time. I have no doubt that you'll make a success of it again.
Well, thank you very much. And I hope you enjoy your much deserved and belated and overdue weekend off from editing this show. All right. You can keep up with all the goings on of the show over at facebook.com/radiofreenintendo. You can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Johnny Metz with no H. The real John Lindemann is somewhere on the Twitterverse.
Globetrotting as usual.
The real John Lindemann is watching live cave paintings.
Yeah. I'm sure he'll be in Boston in triplicate. So,
duplicate.
Also be sure to check out the NWR newscast. They're going to have a lot more detail on the announcements from GDC, so you'll definitely want to check that out. And Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. I'm not sure when the next episode's going out, but I just recorded it with TYP, and we had a lot of fun. So that will probably be up before PAX. You should definitely check that out. And who knows, Radio Trivia might make some kind of appearance at PAX. We shall see. Be sure to send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com and leave us a name or username and your location. All right, we'll see you in Boston. Good night, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Godspeed.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 234. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today, John Lindemann.
What's up, party people?
James Jones.
This is like deja vu.
And Greg Leahy. I
have the feeling that my career's just peaked. I'm going to run out of Oscar acceptance speeches if we have to do this again.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with how Yamauchi actually just operated. I mean, he never really struck me as the kind of typical Japanese corporate guy who was like, well, this person has been with the company for X number of years, so therefore they get put in charge. Like, it always seemed like kind of like a meritocracy, sort of. I mean, outside of Arakawa, you know. It doesn't surprise me that he just kind of looked at somebody and said, you're the man. Like, I picture it like some old kung fu movie sort of thing where it's like, you know, there's just something there where you are the golden child. I give this to you.
Golden child, Jesus.
I do think that...
Who's Charles Dance in this equation?
I heard recently, this might have been on one of the Retronauts live shows, but someone mentioned that Kid Icarus was made by Tosei. I guess that was recently discovered.
The problem with that is that the Tosei thing is such a meme on Retronauts, I'm always kind of hesitant to believe.
Oh, yeah. Like... Well, and also, how would you verify that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, because they presumably like burned all the design docs or whatever. Yeah. The ninja developer. It's quite difficult to find out who made a lot of 8-bit games. They got these like bizarre code names like Fish or whatever. Like, it just back then...
Yeah, and especially when they localized them, they just, a lot of times, just wrote over the names in the credits because they were too Japanese.
Or just put crappy puns like Fred Ascare and
Right, Fred Ascare.
Yeah, you could not do that now.
Apparently, Monkey Fighter 16 selectable characters now.
Oh, gosh.
I don't know.
How many monkeys?
We must cooperate. Yeah, yeah, woo. Magical spell is I poo.
Oh, it burns.
I'm glad the Monkey Ball franchise has adopted the absolute worst features of the Sonic franchise, and it's a rapidly expanding character list.
I and his shitty friends.
God. My vote for worst video game character ever is not one of these multiple, like, bizarre things in Chrono Cross, but actually the female, quote-unquote, robot in Chrono Trigger.
The pink robot, yes.
It's got a bow.
That's hilarious. I like
that's
that
terrible.
Character. I think she's...
It is hilariously bad.